By late evening, the happy tune I had been whistling was forgotten. My back throbbed like a stone bruise. The muscles in my legs and arms started quivering and jerking. I couldn't gulp enough air to cool the burning heat in my lungs. My strength was gone. I could go no further. I sat down and called my dogs to me. With tears in my eyes, I told them that I just couldn't cut the big tree down. I was trying hard to make them understand when I heard someone coming. It was Grandpa in his buggy. I'm sure no one in the world can understand a young boy like his grandfather can. He drove up with a twinkle in his eyes and a smile on his whiskery old face.
"Hello, how you getting along?" he boomed.
"Not so good, Grandpa," I said. "I don't think I can cut it down. It's just too big. I guess I'll have to give up."
"Give up," Grandpa barked. "Now, I don't want to hear you say that. No, sir, that's the last thing I want to hear. Don't ever start anything you can't finish."
"I don't want to give up, Grandpa," I said, "but it's just too big, and my strength's gone. I'm give out."
"Course you are," he said. "You've been going at it wrong. To do work like that, a fella needs plenty of rest and food in his stomach."
"How am I going to get that, Grandpa?" I asked. "I can't leave the tree. If I do, the coon will get away."
"No, he won't," Grandpa said. "That's what I came down here for. I'll show you how to keep that coon in the tree."
He walked around the big sycamore looking up. He whistled and said,
"Boy, this is a big one, all right."
"Yes, it is, Grandpa," I said. "It's the biggest one in the river bottoms." Grandpa started chuckling.
"That's all right," he said. "The bigger they are, the harder they fall."
"How are you going to make a coon stay in the tree, Grandpa?" I asked.
With a proud look on his face, he said, "That's another one of my coon-hunting tricks. Learned it when I was a boy. We'll keep him there, all right. Oh, I don't mean we can keep him there for always, but he'll stay for 4 or 5 days. That is, until he gets so hungry he just has to come down."
"I don't need that much time," I said. "I'm pretty sure I can have it down by tomorrow night." Grandpa looked at the cut.
"I don't know," he said. "Even though it is halfway down, you must remember you've been cutting on it half one night and one day. You might make it, but it's going to take a lot of chopping."
"If I get a good night's sleep," I said, "and a couple of meals under my belt, I can do a lot of chopping."
Grandpa laughed. "Speaking of meals," he said, "your ma is having chicken and dumplings for supper. Now, we don't want to miss that, so let's get busy."
"What do you want me to do, Grandpa?" I asked.
"Well, let's see," he said. "First thing we'll need is some sticks about 5 feet long. Take your axe, go over in that canebrake, and get us 6 of them."
I hurried to do what Grandpa wanted, all the time, wondering what in the world he was going to do. How could he keep the coon in the tree? When I came back, he was taking some old clothes from the buggy.
"Take this stocking cap," he said. "Fill it about half full of grass and leaves."
While I was doing this, Grandpa walked over and started looking up in the tree.
"You're pretty sure he's in that hollow limb, are you?" he asked.
"He's there, all right, Grandpa," I said. "There's no other place he could be. I've looked all over it, and there's no other hollow anywhere."
"Well, in that case," Grandpa said, "we better put our man along about here."
"What man, Grandpa?" I asked in surprise.
"The one we're going to make," he said. "To us it'll be a scarecrow, but to that coon it'll be a man."
Knowing too well how smart coons were, right away I began to lose confidence. "I don't see how anything like that can keep a coon in a tree," I said.
"It'll keep them there all right," Grandpa said. "Like I told you before, they're curious little devils. He'll poke his head out from that hole, see this man standing there, and he won't dare come down. It'll take him 4 or 5 days to figure out that it isn't a real honest-to-goodness man. By that time, it'll be too late. You'll have his hide tacked on the smokehouse wall."
The more I thought about it, the more I believed it. And then there was that serious look on Grandpa's face. That was all it took. I was firmly convinced. I started laughing. The more I thought about it, the funnier it got. Great big laughing tears rolled down my cheek.
"What's so funny?" Grandpa asked. "Don't you believe it'll work?"
"Sure it'll work, Grandpa," I said. "I know it will. I was just thinking, those coons aren't half as smart as they think they are they?" We both had a good laugh at this. With the sticks and some baling wire, Grandpa made a frame that looked almost like a gingerbread man. On this, he put an old pair of pants and a red sweater. We stuffed the loose, flabby clothes with grass and leaves. He wired the stocking cap head in place and stepped back to inspect his work.
"Well, what do you think of it?" he asked.
"If it had a face," I said, "you couldn't tell it from a real man."
"We can fix that," Grandpa chuckled.
He took a stick and dug some black grease from one of the hubcaps on the buggy. I stood and watched while he applied his artistic touch. In the stocking cap head, he made two mean-looking eyes, a crooked nose, and the ugliest mouth I had ever seen.
"Well, what do you think of that?" he asked. "Looks pretty good, huh?"
Laughing fit to kill and talking all at the same time, I told him that I wouldn't blame the coon if he stayed in the tree until Gabriel blew his horn.
"Well, he won't stay that long," Grandpa chuckled, "but he'll stay long enough for you to cut that tree down."
"That's all I want," I said.
"We better be going," Grandpa said. "It's getting late, and we don't want to miss that supper."
I was so stiff and sore, he had to help me to the buggy seat. I called to my dogs. Little Ann came, but not willingly. Old Dan refused to leave the tree. "Come on, boy," I coaxed. "Let's go home and get something to eat. We'll come back tomorrow." He bowed his head and looked the other way. "Come on," I scolded. "We can't sit here all night." This hurt his feelings. He walked around behind the big sycamore and hid.
"Well, I'll be darned," Grandpa said as he jumped down from the buggy. "He knows that coon's there, and he doesn't want to leave it. You've got a coon hound there, and I mean a good one."
He picked old Dan up in his arms and set him in the buggy. All the way home, I had to hold on to his collar to keep him from jumping out and going back to the tree. As our buggy wound its way up through the bottoms, Grandpa started talking.
"You know, Billy," he said, "about this tree chopping of yours, I think it's all right. In fact, I think it would be a good thing if all young boys had to cut down a big tree like that once in their life. It does something for them. It gives them determination and willpower. That's a good thing for a man to have. It goes a long way in his life. The American people have a lot of it. They have proved that all down through history. But they could do with a lot more of it."
I couldn't see this determination and willpower that Grandpa was talking about very clearly. All I could see was a big sycamore tree, a lot of chopping, and the hide of a ringtail coon that I was determined to have. As we reached the house, Mama came out. Right away, she started checking me over. "Are you all right?" she asked. "Sure, Mama," I said. "What makes you think something's wrong with me?" "Well, I didn't know," she said. "The way you acted when you got down from the buggy, I thought maybe you were hurt."
"Oh, he's just a little sore and stiff from all that chopping," Grandpa said. "But he'll be all right. That'll soon go away."
After Mama saw that there were no broken bones or legs chopped off, she smiled and said, "I never know anymore. I guess I'll just have to get used to it." Papa hollered from the porch,
"Come on in. We've been waiting supper on you."
"We're having chicken and dumplings," Mama beamed, "and I cooked them especially for you." During the meal, I told Grandpa I didn't think that the coon in the big tree was the same one my dogs had been trailing at first.
"What makes you think that?" he asked.
I told how the coon had fooled us, and how little Ann had seen or heard this other coon. I figured he had just walked up on my dogs before he realized it.
A smile spread all over Grandpa's face. Chuckling, he said, It does look that way, but it wasn't. No, Billy. It was the same coon. They're much too smart to ever walk up on a hound like that. He pulled a trick, and it was a good one. In fact, it'll fool 9 out of 10 dogs.
"Well, what did he do, Grandpa?" I asked. "I'm pretty sure he didn't cross the river, so how did he work it?"
Grandpa pushed the dishes back, and using his fork as a pencil, he drew an imaginary line on the tablecloth.
"It's called the backtracking trick," he said. "Here's how he worked it. He climbed that water oak, but he only went up about 15 or 20 feet. He then turned around and came down in his same tracks. He backtracked on his original trail for a way. When he heard your dogs coming, he leaped far up on the side of the nearest tree and climbed up. He was in that tree all the time your dogs were searching for the lost trail.
After everything had quieted down, he figured that they had given up. That's when he came down, and that's when little Ann either heard or saw him.
Pointing the fork at me, Grandpa said very seriously,
"You mark my word, Billy. In no time at all, that little Ann will know every trick a coon can pull."
"You know, Grandpa," I said, "she wouldn't bark treed at the water oak like old Dan did."
"Course she wouldn't," he said. "She knew he wasn't there."
"Why, I never heard of such a thing," Mama said. "I'd no idea coons were that smart. Why, for all anyone knows, he may not be in the big tree at all. Maybe he pulled another trick. It'd be a shame if Billy cut it down and found there was no coon in it." "Oh, he's there, Mama," I hastily replied. "I know he is. They were right on his tail when he went up. Besides, little Ann was bawling her head off when I came to them."
"Of course he's there," Grandpa said. "They were crowding him too closely. He didn't have time to pull another trick."
Grandpa left soon after supper, saying to me,
"I'll be back down in a few days, and I want to see that coon hide."
I thanked him for helping me and walked out to the buggy with him.
"Oh, I almost forgot," he said. "I heard there was a fad back in the New England states. Seems like everyone is going crazy over coon skin coats. Now, if this is true, I look for the price of coon hides to take a jump."
I was happy to hear this and told my father what Grandpa had said. Papa laughed and said,
"Well, if you can keep the coons out of those big sycamores, you might make a little money."
Before I went to bed, Mama made me take a hot bath. Then she rubbed me all over with some liniment that burned like fire and smelled like a civet cat. It seemed like I had barely closed my eyes when Mama woke me up. "Breakfast is about ready, Billy," she said.
I was so stiff and sore I had trouble putting my clothes on. Mama helped me.
"Maybe you better let that coon go," she said. "I don't think he's worth all of this."
"I can't do that, Mama," I said. "I've gone too far now."
Papa came in from the barn.
"What's the matter?" he asked. "You a little stiff?"
"A little stiff?" Mama exclaimed. "Why, he could hardly put his clothes on."
"Ah, he'll be all right," Papa said. "If I know anything about swinging an axe, it won't be long before he's as limber as a rag."
Mama just shook her head and started putting our breakfast on the table. While we were eating, Papa said,
"You know, I woke up several times last night, and each time I was sure I heard a hound bawling. Sounded like old Dan."
I quit the table on the run and headed for my doghouse. I didn't have to go all the way. Little Ann met me on the porch. I asked her where old Dan was and called his name. He was nowhere around. Little Ann started acting strangely. She whined and stared toward the river bottoms. She ran out to the gate, came back, and reared up on me. Mama and Papa came out on the porch.
"He's not here," I said. "I think he has gone back to the tree."
"I don't think he'd do that, would he?" Mama said. "Maybe he's around someplace. Have you looked in the doghouse?" I ran and looked. He wasn't there.
"Everybody be quiet and listen," I said.
I walked out beyond the gate a little ways and whooped as loud as I could. My voice rang like a bell in the still, frosty morning. Before the echo had died away, a deep of old Dan rolled out of the river bottoms.
"He's there," I said. "He wanted to make sure the coon stayed in the tree. You see, Mama, why I have to get that coon? I can't let him down."
"Well, I never in all my life," she said. "I had no idea a dog loved to hunt that much."
"Yes, Billy, I can see now. And I want you to get him. I don't care if you have to cut down every tree in those bottoms. I want you to get that coon for those dogs."
"I'm gonna get him, Mama," I said. "And I'm gonna get him today, if I possibly can." Papa laughed and said, "Looks like there wasn't any use in building that scarecrow. All you had to do was tell old Dan to stay and watch the tree."
I left the house in a run. Now and then I would stop and whoop. Each time I was answered by the deep voice of old Dan. Little Ann ran ahead of me. By the time I reached the big tree, their voices were making the bottoms ring. When I came tearing out of the underbrush, old Dan threw a fit. He tried to climb the sycamore. He would back way off, then bawling and running as fast as he could, he would claw his way far up on its side. Little Ann, not to be outdone, reared up and placed her small front paws on the smooth white bark. She told the ringtail coon that she knew he was there. After they had quieted down, I called old Dan to me.
"I'm proud of you, boy," I said. It takes a good dog to stay with a tree all night. But there wasn't any need in you coming back. The coon wouldn't have gotten away. That's why we built the scarecrow. Little Anne came over and started rolling in the leaves. The way I was feeling toward her, I couldn't even smile at her playful mood. Of course you feel good, I said in an irritated voice, and it's no wonder. You had a good night's sleep in a nice warm doghouse, but old Dan didn't. He was down here in the cold all by himself, watching the tree. The way you're acting, I don't believe you care if the coon gets away or not. I would have said more, but just then I noticed something. I walked over for a better look. There, scratched deep in the soft leaves, were two little beds. One was smaller than the other. Looking at little Anne, I read the answer in her warm gray eyes. Old Dan hadn't been alone when he had gone back to the tree. She, too, had gone along. There was no doubt that in the early morning she had come home to get me. There was a lump in my throat as I said, "I'm sorry, little girl. I should have known." The first half hour was torture. At each swing of the axe, my arms felt like they were being torn from their sockets. I gritted my teeth and kept hacking away. My body felt like it did the time my sister rolled me down the hill in a barrel. As Papa had said, in a little while the warm heat from the hard work limbered me up. I remembered what my father did when he was swinging an axe. At the completion of each swing, he always said, "Ha!" I tried it. "Kawam! Ha! Kawam! Ha!" I didn't know if it helped or not, but I was willing to try anything if it would hurry the job. Several times before noon I had to stop and rake my chips out of the way. I noticed that they weren't the big, even, solid chips like my father made when he was chopping. They were small and seemed to crumble up and come all to pieces. Neither were the cuts, neat and even. They were ragged and looked more like the work of beavers. But I wasn't interested in any beautiful tree chopping. All I wanted was to hear the big sycamore start popping. Along in the middle of the afternoon, I felt a stinging in one of my hands. When I saw it was a blister, I almost cried. At first there was only one, then two. One after another, they rose up on my hands like small white marbles. They filled up and turned a pale pinkish color. When one would burst, it was all I could do to keep from screaming. I tore my handkerchief in half and wrapped my hands. This helped for a while, but when the cloth began to stick to the raw flesh, I knew it was the end. Crying my heart out, I called my dogs to me and showed them my hands. "I can't do it," I said. "I've tried, but I just can't cut it down. I can't hold the axe any longer." Little Anne whined and started licking my sore hands. Old Dan seemed to understand. He showed his sympathy by nuzzling me with his head. Broken-hearted, I started for home. As I turned, from the corner of my eye, I saw Grandpa's scarecrow. It seemed to be laughing at me. I looked over to the big sycamore. It lacked so little being cut down. A small wedge of solid wood was all that was holding it up. I let my eyes follow the smooth white trunk up to the huge spreading limbs. Sobbing, I said, "You think you have won, but you haven't. Although I can't get the coon, neither can you live, because I have cut off your breath of life." And then I thought, why kill the big tree and not accomplish anything? I began to feel bad. Kneeling down between my dogs, I cried and prayed, "Please, God, give me the strength to finish the job. I don't want to leave the big tree like that. Please, help me finish the job." I was trying to rewrap my hand so I could go back to work when I heard a low droning sound. I stood up and looked around. I could still hear the noise but couldn't locate it. I looked up. High in the top of the big sycamore, a breeze had started the limbs to swaying. A shudder ran through the huge trunk. I looked over to my right at a big black gum tree. Not one limb was moving. On its branches, a few dead leaves hung silent and still. One dropped and floated lazily toward the ground. Over on my left stood a large hackberry. I looked up to its top. It was as still as a fence post. Another gust of wind caught in the top of the big tree. It started popping and snapping. I knew it was going to fall. Grabbing my dogs by their collars, I backed off to safety. I held my breath. The top of the big sycamore rocked and swayed. There was a loud crack that seemed to come from deep inside the heavy trunk. Fascinated, I stood and watched the giant of the bottoms. It seemed to be fighting so hard to keep standing. Several times I thought it would fall, but in a miraculous way it would pull itself back into perfect balance. The wind itself seemed to be angry at the big tree's stubborn resistance. It growled and moaned as it pushed harder against the wavering top. With one final grinding, creaking sigh, the big sycamore started down. It picked up momentum as the heavy weight of the overbalanced top dove for the ground. A small ash was smothered by its huge bulk. There was a lightning-like crack as its trunk snapped. In its downward plunge, the huge limb stripped the branches from the smaller trees. A log-sized one knifed through the top of a water oak. Splintered limbs flew skyward and rained out over the bottoms. With a cyclone roar, the big tree crashed to the ground. And then silence settled over the bottoms. Out of the broken, twisted, tangled mass streaked a brown, furry ball. I turned my dogs loose and started screaming at the top of my voice, "Get him, Dan, get him!" In his eagerness, old Dan ran head-on into a bur oak tree. He sat down and with his deep voice told the river bottoms that he had been hurt. It was little Ann who caught the coon. I heard the ringtail squall when she grabbed him. Scared half to death, I snatched up a club and ran to help her. The coon was all over her. He climbed up on her head, growling, slashing, ripping, and tearing. Yelping with pain, she shook him off, and he streaked for the river. I thought surely he was going to get away. At the very edge of the river's bank, she caught him again. I was trying hard to get in a lick with my club, but couldn't for fear of hitting little Ann. Through the tears in my eyes, I saw the red, blurry form of old Dan sail into the fight. He was a mad hound. His anger at the bur oak tree was taken out on the coon. They stretched old Ringy out between them and pinned him to the ground. It was savage and brutal. I could hear the dying squalls of the coon and the deep growls of old Dan. In a short time, it was all over. With sorrow in my heart, I stood and watched while my dogs worried the lifeless body. Little Ann was satisfied first. I had to scold old Dan to make him stop. Carrying the coon by a hind leg, I walked back to the big tree for my axe. Before leaving for home, I stood and looked at the fallen sycamore. I should have felt proud over the job I had done, but for some reason I couldn't. I knew I would miss the giant of the bottoms, for it had played a wonderful part in my life. I thought of the hours I had whiled away staring at its beauty and how hard it had been finding the right name for it. "I'm sorry," I said. "I didn't want to cut you down, but I had to. I hope you can understand." I was a proud boy as I walked along in the twilight of the evening. I felt so good. Even my sore hands had stopped hurting. What boy wouldn't have been proud? Hadn't my little hounds treed and killed their first coon? Along about then, I decided I was a full-fledged coon hunter. Nearing our house, I saw the whole family had come out on the porch. My sisters came running, staring wide-eyed at the dead coon. Laughing, Papa said, "Well, I see you got him." "I sure did, Papa," I said.
I held the coon up for all to see. Mama took one look at the lifeless body and winced.
"Billy," she said, "when I heard that big tree fall, it scared me half to death. I didn't know but what it had fallen on you." "Oh, Mama," I said, "I was safe. Why, I backed way off to one side. It couldn't have fallen on me."
Mama just shook her head.
"I don't know," she said. "Sometimes I wonder if all mothers have to go through this."
"Come on," Papa said. "I'll help you skin it."
While we were tacking the hide on the smokehouse wall, I asked Papa if he had noticed any wind blowing that evening. He thought a bit and said,
"No, I don't believe I did. I've been out all day, and I'm pretty sure I haven't noticed any wind. Why did you ask?"
"Oh, I don't know, Papa," I said. "But I thought something strange happened down in the bottoms this afternoon."
I'm afraid I don't understand, said Papa. What do you mean something strange happened?
I told them about how my hands had gotten so sore I couldn't chop anymore and how I had asked for strength to finish the job.
Well, what's so strange about that? He asked.
I don't know, I said. But I didn't chop the big tree down. The wind blew it over.
Why, that's nothing, Papa said. I've seen that happen a lot of times.
It wasn't just the wind, I said. It was the way it blew. It didn't touch another tree in the bottoms. I know, because I looked around. The big tree was the only one touched by the wind. Do you think God heard my prayer? Do you think he helped me?
Papa looked at the ground and scratched his head. In a sober voice, he said,
I don't know, Billy. I'm afraid I can't answer that. You must remember, the big sycamore was the tallest tree in the bottoms. Maybe it was up there high enough to catch the wind where the others couldn't. No, I'm afraid I can't help you there. You'll have to decide for yourself.
It wasn't hard for me to decide. I was firmly convinced that I had been helped.
Mama made me a cap out of my first coon hide. I was as proud of it as Papa would have been if someone had given him a dozen Missouri mules. Mama said afterwards that she wished she hadn't made it for me because in some way wearing that cap must have affected my mind. I went coon crazy. I was out after ringtails every night. About the only time I didn't go hunting was when the weather was bad, and even then Mama all but had to hog-tie me. What wonderful nights they were. Running like a deer through the thick timber of the bottoms, tearing my way through stands of wild cane, climbing over drifts and jumping logs, running, screaming, and yelling, "Woo-wee! Get 'em, boy, get 'em!" following the voices of my little hounds. It wasn't too hard for a smart old coon to fool old Dan, but there were none that prowled the river banks that could fool my little Ann. As Grandpa had predicted, the price of coonskins jumped sky high. A good size hide was worth from $4 to $10, depending on the grade and quality. I kept the side of our smokehouse plastered with hides. Of course, I would spread them out a little to cover more space. I always stretched them on the side facing the road, never on the back side. I wanted everyone in the country to see them. The money earned from my furs was turned over to my father. I didn't care about it. I had what I wanted, my dogs. I supposed that Papa was saving it for something, because I never saw anything new turn up around our home. But like any young boy, I wasn't bothered by it, and I asked no questions. My whole life was wrapped up in my dogs. Everywhere I went, they went along. There was only one place I didn't want them to go with me, and that was to Grandpa's store. Other dogs were always there, and it seemed as if they all wanted to jump on old Dan. It got so about the only time I went to see my grandfather was when I had a bundle of fur to take to the store. This was always a problem. In every way I could, I would try to slip away from my dogs. Sometimes I swore that they could read my mind. It made no difference what I tried. I couldn't fool them. One time I was sure I had outsmarted them. The day before I was to make one of my trips, I took my furs out to the barn and hid them. The next morning I hung around the house for a while and then nonchalantly whistled my way out to the barn. I climbed up in the loft and peeked through a crack. I could see them lying in front of their doghouse. They weren't even looking my way. Taking my furs, I sneaked out through a back door, and walking like a tomcat, I made it to the timber. I climbed a small dogwood tree and looked back. They were still there and didn't seem to know what I'd done. Feeling just about as smart as Sherlock Holmes, I headed for the store. I was walking along, singing my lungs out, when they came tearing out of the underbrush, wriggling and twisting and tickled to death to be with me. At first I was mad, but one look at dancing little Ann and all was forgiven. I sat down on my bundle of fur and laughed till I hurt all over. I could scold them a little, but I could no more have whipped one of them than I could have kissed a girl. After all, a boy just doesn't whip his dogs. Grandpa always counted my furs carefully and marked something down on a piece of paper. I'd never seen him do this with other hunters, and it got the best of my curiosity. One day, while he was writing, I asked him, "Why do you do that, Grandpa?" He looked at me over his glasses and said, kind of sharp,
"Never mind. I have my reasons."
When Grandpa talked to me like that, I didn't push things any farther. Besides, it didn't make any difference to me if he marked on every piece of paper in the store. I always managed to make my trips on Saturdays, as that was Coon Hunter's Day. I didn't have to stand around on the outside of the circle anymore and listen to the coon hunters. I'd get right up in the middle and say my piece with the rest of them. I didn't have to tell any whoppers, for some of the things my dogs did were almost unbelievable anyhow. Oh, I guess I did make things a little bigger than they actually were, but I never did figure a coon hunter told honest-to-goodness lies. He just kind of stretched things a little. I could hold those coon hunters spellbound with some of my hunting tales. Grandpa would never say anything while I was telling my stories. He just puttered around the store with a silly little grin on his face. Once in a while, when I got too far off the beaten path, he would come around and cram a bar of soap in my pocket. My face would get all red. I'd cut my story short, fly out the door, and head for home. The coon hunters were always kidding me about my dogs. Some of the remarks I heard made me fighting mad.
I never saw hounds so small, but I guess they are hounds. At least they look like it.
I don't believe little Ann is half as smart as he says she is. She's so little, those old coons think she's a rabbit. I'll bet she sneaks right up on them before they realize she's a dog.
Some of these nights, a big old coon's going to carry her off to his den and raise some little coon puppies.
I always took their kidding with a smile on my face, but it made my blood boil like the water in Mama's tea kettle. I had one way of shutting them up.
"Let's all go in the store," I'd say, "and see who has the most hides in there."
It was true that my dogs were small, especially little Ann. She could walk under an ordinary hound. In fact, she was a regular midget. If it had not been for her long ears, no one could have told that she was a hound. Her actions weren't those of a hunting hound. She was constantly playing. She would play with our chickens and young calves, with a piece of paper or a corn cob. What my little girl lacked in size, she made up in sweetness. She could make friends with a tomcat. Old Dan was just the opposite. He strutted around with a belligerent and tough attitude. Although he wasn't a tall dog, he was heavy. His body was long and his chest broad and thick. His legs were short, big, and solid. The muscles in his body were hard and knotty. When he walked, they would twist and jerk under the skin. He was a friendly dog. There were no strangers to him. He loved everyone.
Yet he was a strange dog. He would not hunt with another hound other than little Ann or another hunter, not even my father.
The strangest thing about old Dan was that he would not hunt, even with me, unless little Ann was with him. I found this out the first night I tried it. Little Ann had cut the pad of her right foot on a sharp, jagged flint rock. It was a nasty cut. I made a little boot of leather and put it on her wounded foot. To keep her from following me, I locked her in the corn crib. Two nights later, I decided to take old Dan hunting for a while. He followed me down to the river bottoms and disappeared in the thick timber. I waited and waited for him to strike a trail. Nothing happened. After about 2 hours, I called to him. He didn't come. I called and called. Disgusted, I gave up and went home. Coming up through the barn lot, I saw him rolled up in a ball on the ground in front of the corn crib. I immediately understood. I walked over and opened the door. He jumped up in the crib, smelled little Ann's foot, twisted around in the shucks, and lay down by her side. As he looked at me, I read this message in his friendly gray eyes. "You could have done this a long time ago." I never did know if little Ann would hunt by herself or not. I'm sure she would have, for she was a smart and understanding dog, but I never tried to find out. Little Ann was my sister's pet. They rubbed and scratched and petted her. They would take her down to the creek and give her baths. She loved it all. If Mama wanted a chicken caught, she would call little Ann. She would run the chicken down and hold it with her paws until Mama came. Not one feather would be harmed. Mama tried old Dan once. Before she got the chicken, there wasn't much left but the feathers.
By some strange twist of nature, little Ann was destined to go through life without being a mother. Perhaps it was because she was stunted in growth, or maybe because she was the runt in a large litter. That may have had something to do with it.
During the fur season, November through February, I was given complete freedom from work.
Many times when I came home, the sun was high in the sky. After each hunt, I always took care of my dogs. The flint rocks and saw briars were hard on their feet. With a bottle of peroxide and a can of salve, I would doctor their wounds. I never knew what to expect from old Dan. I never saw a coon hound so determined, or one that could get into so many predicaments. More than one time, it would have been the death of him if it hadn't been for smart little Ann. One night, not long after I had entered the bottoms, my dogs struck the trail of an old boar coon. He was a smart old fellow and had a sack full of tricks. He crossed the river time after time. Finally, swimming to the middle and staying in the swift current, he swam downstream. Knowing he would have to come out somewhere, my dogs split up. Old Dan took the right side, little Ann worked the other side. I came out of the bottoms onto a gravel bar and stood and watched them in the moonlight. Little Ann worked downriver, and then she came up. I saw her when she passed me going up the bank, sniffing and searching for the trail. She came back to me. I patted her head, scratched her ears, and talked to her. She kept staring across the river to where old Dan was searching for the trail. She waded in and swam across to help him. I knew that the coon had not come out of the river on her side. If he had, she would have found the trail. I walked up to a riffle, pulled off my shoes, and waded across. My dogs worked the riverbank up and down. They circled far out into the bottoms. I could hear the loud snuffing of old Dan. He was bewildered and mad. I was getting a thrill from it all, as I had never seen them fooled like this. Old Dan gave up on his side, piled into the river, and swam across to the side little Ann had worked. I knew that it was useless for him to do that. I was on the point of giving up, calling them to me and going elsewhere to hunt, when I heard the bawl of little Ann. I couldn't believe what I heard. She wasn't bawling on a trail. She was sounding the tree bark. I hurried down the bank. There was a loud splash. I saw old Dan swimming back. By this time, little Ann was really singing a song. In the bright moonlight, I could see old Dan clearly. His powerful front legs were churning the water. Then I saw a sight that makes a hunter's heart swell with pride. Still swimming, old Dan raised his head high out of the water and bawled. He couldn't wait until he reached the bank to tell little Ann he was coming. From far out in the river, he told her. Reaching the shallows, he plowed out of the river onto a sandbar, not even taking time to shake the water from his body. Again, he raised his head and bawled and tore out down the bank. In a trot, I followed, whooping to let them know I was coming. Before I reached the tree, old Dan's deep voice was making the timber shake. The tree was a large birch standing right on the bank of the river. The swift current had eaten away the footing, causing it to lean. The lower branches of the tree dangled in the water. I saw how the smart old coon had pulled his trick. Coming in toward the bank from midstream, he had caught the dangling limbs and climbed up. Exhausted from the long swim, he stayed there in the birch, thinking he had outsmarted my dogs. I couldn't understand how little Ann had found him. It was impossible to fall the tree toward the bottoms. It was too much off balance. I did the next best thing. I cut a long elder switch. Unbuckling one of my suspenders, I tied it to the end and climbed the tree. The coon was sitting in a fork of a limb. Taking my switch, I whopped him a good one, and out he came. He sailed out over the river. With a loud splash, he hit the water and swam for the other side. My dogs jumped off the bank after him. They were no match against his expert swimming. On reaching the other bank, he ran downriver. Climbing down out of the tree, I picked up my axe and lantern and trotted down to another riffle and waded across. I could tell by the bawling of my dogs they were close to the coon. He would have to climb a tree or be caught on the ground. All at once, their voices stopped. I stood still and waited for them to bawl treed. Nothing happened. Thinking the coon had taken to the river again, I waited to give them time to reach the opposite bank. I waited and waited. I could hear nothing. By then I knew he had not crossed over. I thought perhaps they had caught him on the ground. I hurried on. I came to a point where a slough of crystal clear water ran into the river. On the other side was a bluff. I could hear one of my dogs over there. As I watched and waited, I heard a dog jump in the water. It was little Ann. She swam across and came up to me. Staying with me for just a second, she jumped in the slough and swam back to the other side. I could hear her sniffing and whining. I couldn't figure out where old Dan was. By squatting down and holding the lantern high over my head, I could dimly see the opposite bank. Little Ann was running up and down. I noticed she always stayed in one place of about 25 yards, never leaving that small area. She ran down to the water's edge and stared out into the slough. The horrible thought came that old Dan had drowned. I knew a big coon was capable of drowning a dog in water by climbing on his head and forcing him under. As fast as I could run, I circled the slough, climbed up over the bluff, and came down to where little Ann was. She was hysterical, running up and down the bank and whining. I tied my lantern on a long pole, held it out over the water, and looked for old Dan's body. I could see clearly in the clear spring waters, but I couldn't see my dog anywhere. I sat down on the bank, buried my face in my hands, and cried. I was sure he was gone. Several minutes passed, and all that time little Ann had never stopped. Running here and there along the bank, she kept sniffing and whining. I heard when she started digging. I looked around. She was 10 feet from the water's edge. I got up and went over to her. She was digging in a small hole about the size of a big apple. It was the air hole for a muskrat den. I pulled little Ann away from the hole, knelt down, and put my ear to it. I could hear something and feel a vibration in the ground. It was an eerie sound and seemed to be coming from far away. I listened. Finally, I understood what the noise was. It was the voice of old Dan. Little Ann had opened the hole up enough with her digging so his voice could be heard faintly. In some way, he had gotten into that old muskrat den. I knew that down under the bank in the water, the entrance to the den could be found. Rolling up my sleeve, I tried to find it with my hand. I had no luck. It was too far down. There was only one thing to do. Leaving my axe and lantern, I ran for home. Picking up a long-handled shovel, I hurried back. The sun was high in the sky before I had dug old Dan out. He was a sight to see, nothing but mud from the tip of his nose to the end of his tail. I held on to his collar and led him down to the river to wash him off. The water there was much warmer than the cold spring water of the slough. After washing him, I turned him loose. Right back to the hole he ran. Little Ann was already digging. I knew the coon was still there. Working together, we dug him out. After the coon was killed, I saw what had made him so smart. His right front foot was twisted and shriveled. At one time, he must have been caught in a trap and had pulled himself free. He was an old coon. His face was almost white. He was big and heavy and had beautiful fur. Tired, muddy, wet, and hungry, I started for home. I've often wondered how old Dan got into that old muskrat den. Perhaps there was another entrance I had overlooked. I'll never know. One night, far back in the mountains, in a place called the Cyclone Timber, old Dan really pulled a good one. Many years before my time, a terrible cyclone had ripped its way through the mountains, leaving its scar in the form of fallen timber, twisted and snarled. The path of the cyclone was several miles wide and several miles long. It was a wonderful place to hunt, as it abounded with game. My dogs had struck the trail of a coon about an hour before. They had really been warming him up. I knew it was about time for him to take up a tree, and sure enough, I heard the deep voice of old Dan telling the world he had a coon up a tree. I was trotting along, going to them, when his voice stopped. I could hear little Ann, but not old Dan. I wondered why, and was a little scared, for I just knew something had happened. Then I heard his voice. It seemed louder than it had been before. I felt much better. When I came up to the tree, I thought little Ann had treed old Dan. She was sitting on her haunches, staring up and bawling the tree bark. There, a good 15 feet from the ground, with his hind legs planted firmly in the center of a big limb and his front feet against the trunk of the tree, stood old Dan, bawling for all he was worth. Above him, some 8 or 9 feet, was a baby coon. I was glad it was a young one, for if it had been an old one, he would have jumped out. Old Dan would have followed, and he surely would have broken all of his legs. From where I was standing, I could see it was impossible for old Dan to have climbed the tree. It was dead and more of an old snag than a tree, with limbs that were crooked and twisted. The bark had rotted away and fallen off, leaving the trunk bare and slick as glass. It was a good 10 feet up to the first limb. I couldn't figure out how old Dan had climbed that tree. There had to be a solution somewhere. Walking around to the other side, I saw how he had accomplished his feat. There in the bottom was a large hole. The old tree was hollow. Stepping back, I looked up and could see another hole which had been hidden from me because of old Dan's body. He had simply crawled into the hole at the bottom, climbed up the hollow of the tree, and worked his way out on the limb. In some way, he had turned around and reared up, placing his front feet against the trunk. There he was. I didn't know what to do. I couldn't cut the tree down, and I was afraid to climb it for fear I would scare the coon into jumping out. If he did, old Dan would jump too and break his legs. I ran plan after plan around in my mind. None would work. I finally came to the conclusion that I had to climb the tree and get a hold of that crazy dog. I blew out my lantern, pulled off my shoes and socks, and started shimmying up the tree. I prayed that the coon wouldn't jump out. Inching along, being as quiet as I could, I made it up to old Dan and grabbed his collar. I sat down on the limb and held him tight. He would bawl now and then and all but burst my eardrums. I couldn't drop him to the ground, and I couldn't climb down with him. I couldn't sit there on that limb and hold him all night. I would be no better off when daylight came. Glancing at the hole by my side gave me the solution to my problem. I thought, if he came out of this hole, he can go back in it. That was the way I got my dog down from the tree. This had its problems, too. In the first place, old Dan didn't want to be put in the hole head first. By scolding, pushing, shoving, and squeezing, I finally got him started on his way. Like a fool, I sat there on the limb, waiting to see him come out at the bottom, and come out he did. Turning around, bawling as he did, right back in the hole he went. There was nothing I could do but sit and wait. I understood why his voice had stopped for a while. He just took time out to climb a tree. Putting my ear to the hole, I could hear him coming, grunting and clawing. Up he came. I helped him out of the hole, turned him around, and crammed him back in. That time I wasn't too gentle with my work. I was tired of sitting on the limb, and my bare feet were getting cold. I started down the same time he did. He beat me down. Looking over my shoulder, I saw him turn around and head back for the hole. I wasn't far from the ground, so I let go. The flint rocks didn't feel too good to my feet when I landed. I jumped to the hole just in time to see the tip end of his long tail disappearing. I grabbed it. Holding on with one hand, I worked his legs down with my other and pulled him out. I stopped his tree climbing by cramming rocks and chunks into the hole. How the coon stayed in the tree, I'll never know, but stay he did. With a well-aimed rock, I scared him out. Old Dan satisfied his lust to kill. I started for home. I'd had all the hunting I wanted for that night. I had often wondered what old Dan would do if little Anne got into some kind of a predicament. One night, I got my answer. For several days, a northern blizzard had been blowing. It was a bad one. The temperature dropped down to 10 below. The storm started with a slow, cold drizzle, and then sleet. When the wind started blowing, everything froze, leaving the ground as slick as glass. Trapped indoors, I was as nervous as a fish out of water. I told Mama I guessed it was just going to storm all winter. She laughed and said, "I don't think it will, but it does look like it will last for a while." She ruffled up my hair and kissed me between the eyes. This did rile me up. I didn't like to be kissed like that. It seemed that I could practically rub my skin off and still feel it all wet and sticky and kind of burning. Sometime on the fifth night, the storm blew itself out, and it snowed about 3 inches. The next morning, I went out to my doghouse. Scraping the snow away from the two-way door, I stuck my head in. It was as warm as an oven. I got my face washed all over by little Anne. Old Dan's tail thumped out a tune on the wall. I told him to be ready, because we were going hunting that night. I knew the old ringtails would be hungry and stirring, for they had been denned up during the storm. That evening, as I was leaving the house, Papa said, "Billy, be careful tonight. It's slick down under the snow, and it would be easy to twist an ankle or break a leg." I told him I would, and that I wasn't going far, just down back of our fields in the bottoms. "Well, anyway," he said, "be careful. There'll be no moon tonight, and you're going to see some fog next to the river." Walking through our fields, I saw my father was right about it being slick and dark. Several times I slipped and sat down. I couldn't see anything beyond the glow of my lantern, but I wasn't worried. My light was a good one. and Mama had insisted that I make two little leather pouches to cover the blades of my axe. Just before I reached the timber, old Dan shook the snow from the underbrush with his deep voice. I stopped and listened. He bawled again. The deep bass tones rolled around under the tall sycamores, tore their way out of the thick timber, traveled out over the fields, and slammed up against the foothills. There they seemed to break up and die away in the mountains. Old Dan was working the trail slowly, and I knew why. He would never line out until little Ann was running by his side. I thought she would never get there. When she did, her beautiful voice made the blood pound in my temples. I felt the excitement of the hunt as it ate its way into my body. Taking a deep breath, I reared back and whooped as loud as I could. The coon ran up river for a way, and then, cutting out of the bottoms, he headed for the mountains. I stood and listened until their voices went out of hearing. Slipping and sliding, I started in the direction I had last heard them. About halfway to the foothills, I heard them coming back. Somewhere in the rugged mountains, the coon had turned and headed toward the river. It was about time for him to play out a few tricks, and I was wondering what he would do. I knew it would be hard for him to hide his trail with snow on the ground, and I realized later that the smart old coon knew this too. As the voices of my dogs grew louder, I could tell that they were coming straight toward me. Once I started to blow out my lantern, thinking that maybe I could see them when they crossed our field, but I realized I didn't stand a chance of seeing the race in the skunk black night. Down out of the mountains they brought him, singing a hound dog song on his heels. The coon must have scented me or seen my lantern. He cut to my right and ran between our house and me. I heard screaming and yelling from my sisters. My father started whooping. I knew my whole family was out on the porch listening to the beautiful voices of my little red hounds. I felt as tall as the tallest sycamore on the riverbank. I yelled as loud as I could. Again I heard the squealing of my sisters and the shouts of my father. The deep woo-woo-woo-woo of old Dan and the sharp of little Ann bored a hole in the inky black night. The vibrations rolled and quivered in the icy silence. The coon was heading for the river. I could tell my dogs were crowding him and wondered if he'd make it to the water. I was hoping he wouldn't, for I didn't want to wade the cold water unless I had to do it. I figured the smart old coon had a reason for turning and coming back to the river and wondered what trick he had in mind. I remembered something my grandfather had told me. He said, "Never underestimate the cunning of an old river coon. When the nights are dark and the ground is frozen and slick, they can pull some mean tricks on a hound. Sometimes the tricks can be fatal." I was halfway through the fog-covered bottoms when the voices of my dogs stopped. I stood still, waited, and listened. A cold silence settled over the bottoms. I could hear the snap and crack of sap-frozen limbs. From far back in the flinty hills, the long, lonesome howl of a timber wolf floated down in the silent night. Across the river, I heard a cow moo. I knew the sound was coming from the Lowry place. Not being able to hear the voices of my dogs gave me an uncomfortable feeling. I whooped and waited for one of them to bawl. As I stood waiting, I realized something was different in the bottoms. Something was missing. I wasn't worried about my dogs. I figured that the coon had pulled some trick, and sooner or later they would unravel the trail. But the feeling that something was just not right had me worried. I whooped several times, but still could get no answer. Stumbling, slipping, and sliding, I started on. Reaching the river, I saw it was frozen over. I realized what my strange, uneasy feeling was. I had not been able to hear the sound of the water. As I stood, listening, I heard a gurgling out in the middle of the stream. The river wasn't frozen all the way across. The still, eddy waters next to the banks had frozen, but out in the middle where the current was swift, the water was running, leaving a trough in the ice pack. The gurgling sound I had heard was the swift current as it sucked its way through the channel. The last time I had heard my dogs, they were downstream from me. I walked on, listening. I hadn't gone far when I heard old Dan. What I heard froze the blood in my veins. He wasn't bawling on a trail or giving the tree bark. It was one long, continuous cry. In his deep voice, there seemed to be a pleading cry for help. Scared, worried, and with my heart beating like a churn dasher, I started toward the sound. I almost passed him, but with another cry, he let me know where he was.
He was out on the ice pack. I couldn't see him for the fog. I called to him, and he answered with a low whine. Again I called his name. This time he came to me. He wasn't the same dog. His tail was between his legs, and his head was bowed down. He stopped about 7 feet from me. Sitting down on the ice, he raised his head and howled the most mournful cry I had ever heard. Turning around, he trotted back out on the ice and disappeared in the fog. I knew something had happened to little Anne. I called her name. She answered with a pleading cry. Although I couldn't see her, I guessed what had happened. The coon had led them to the river. Running out on the ice, he had leaped across the trough. My dogs, hot on the trail, had followed. Old Dan, a more powerful dog than little Anne, had made his leap. Little Anne had not made it. Her small feet had probably slipped on the slick ice, and she had fallen into the icy waters. Old Dan, seeing the fate of his little friend, had quit the chase and come back to help her. The smart old coon had pulled his trick, and a deadly one it was. I had to do something. She would never be able to get out by herself. It was only a matter of time until her body would be paralyzed by the freezing water. Laying my axe down, I held my lantern out in front of me and stepped out on the ice. It started cracking and popping. I jumped back to the bank. Although it was thick enough to hold the light weight of my dogs, it would never hold me. Little Anne started whining and begging for help. I went all to pieces and started crying. Something had to be done, and done quickly, or my little dog was lost. I thought of running home for a rope or for my father, but I knew she couldn't last until I got back. I was desperate. It was impossible for me to swim in the freezing water. I wouldn't last for a minute. She cried again, begging for the one thing I couldn't give her, help. I thought, if only I could see her, maybe I could figure out some way I could help. Looking at my lantern gave me an idea. I ran up the bank about 30 feet, turned and looked back. I could see the light, not well, but enough for what I had in mind. I grabbed my lantern and axe and ran for the bottoms. I was looking for a stand of wild cane. After what seemed like ages, I found it. With the longest one I could find, I hurried back. After it was trimmed and the limber end cut off, I hung the lantern by the handle on the end of it and started easing it out on the ice. I saw old Dan first. He was sitting close to the edge of the trough, looking down. Then I saw her. I groaned at her plight. All I could see was her head and her small front paws. Her claws were spread out and digging into the ice. She knew if she ever lost that hold, she was gone. Old Dan raised his head and howled. Hound though he was, he knew it was the end of the trail for his little pal. I wanted to get my light as close to little Anne as I could, but my pole was a good 8 feet short. Setting the lantern down, I eased the pole from under the handle. I thought, I'm no better off than I was before. In fact, I'm worse off. Now I can see when the end comes. Little Anne cried again. I saw her claws slip on the ice. Her body settled lower in the water. Old Dan howled and started fidgeting. He knew the end was close. I didn't exactly know when I started out toward my dog. I had taken only 2 steps when the ice broke. I twisted my body and fell toward the bank. Just as my hand closed on a root, I thought my feet touched bottom, but I wasn't sure. As I pulled myself out, I felt the numbing cold creep over my legs. It looked so hopeless. There didn't seem to be any way I could save her. At the edge of the water stood a large sycamore. I got behind it, anything to blot out that heartbreaking scene. Little Anne, thinking I had deserted her, started crying. I couldn't stand it. I opened my mouth to call old Dan. I wanted to tell him to come on and we'd go home, as there was nothing we could do. The words just wouldn't come out. I couldn't utter a sound. I lay my face against the icy, cold bark of the sycamore. I thought of the prayer I had said when I had asked God to help me get 2 hound pups. I knelt down and sobbed out a prayer. I asked for a miracle which would save the life of my little dog. I promised all the things that a young boy could, if only he would help me. Still saying my prayer and making promises, I heard a sharp metallic sound. I jumped up and stepped away from the tree. I was sure the noise I had heard was made by a rattling chain on the front end of a boat. I shouted as loud as I could, "Over here! I need help! My dog is drowning!" I waited for an answer. All I could hear were the cries of little Anne. Again I hollered, "Over here! Over on the bank! Can you see my light? I need help! Please, hurry!" I held my breath, waiting for an answering shout.
I shivered from the freezing cold of my wet shoes and overalls. A straining silence settled over the river. A feathery rustle swished by in the blackness. A flock of low-flying ducks had been disturbed by my loud shouts. I strained my ears for some sound. Now and then I could hear the lapping slap of the ice-cold water as it swirled its way through the trough. I glanced to little Anne. She was still holding on, but I saw her paws were almost at the edge. I knew her time was short. I couldn't figure out what I had heard. The sound was made by metal, striking metal, but what was it? What could have caused it? I looked at my axe. It couldn't have made the sound, as it was too close to me. The noise had come from out in the river. When I looked at my lantern, I knew that it had made the strange sound. I had left the handle standing straight up when I had taken the pole away. Now it was down. For some unknown reason, the stiff wire handle had twisted in the sockets and dropped. As it had fallen, it had struck the metal frame, making the sharp metallic sound I had heard. As I stared at the yellow glow of my light, the last bit of hope faded away. I closed my eyes, intending to pray again for the help I so desperately needed. Then, like a blinding red flash, the message of the lantern bored its way into my brain. There was my miracle. There was the way to save my little dog. In the metallic sound I had heard were my instructions. They were so plain I couldn't help but understand them. The bright yellow flame started flickering and dancing. It seemed to be saying, "Hurry! You know what to do!" Faster than I had ever moved in my life, I went to work. With a stick, I measured the water in the hole where my feet had broken through the ice. I was right. My foot had touched bottom. 18 inches down, I felt the soft mud. With my pole, I fished the lantern back to the bank. I took the handle off, straightened it out, and bent a hook in one end. With one of my shoelaces, I tied the wire to the end of the cane pole. I left the hook sticking out about 6 inches beyond the end of it. I started shouting encouragement to little Anne. I told her to hang on and not to give up, for I was going to save her. She answered with a low cry. With the hook stuck in one of the ventilating holes in the top of my light, I lifted it back out on the ice and set it down. After a little wiggling and pushing, I worked the hook loose and laid the pole down. I took off my clothes, picked up my axe, and stepped down into the hole in the icy water. It came to my knees. Step by step, breaking the ice with my axe, I waded out. The water came up to my hips and then to my waist. The cold bite of it took my breath away. I felt my body grow numb. I couldn't feel my feet at all, but I knew they were moving. When the water reached my armpits, I stopped and worked my pole toward little Anne. Stretching my arms as far out as I could, I saw I was still a foot short. Closing my eyes and gritting my teeth, I moved on. The water reached my chin. I was close enough. I started hooking at the collar of little Anne. Time after time, I felt the hook almost catch. I saw I was fishing on a wrong angle. She had settled so low in the water I couldn't reach her collar. Raising my arms above my head so the pole would be on a slant, I kept hooking and praying. The seconds ticked by. I strained for one more inch. The muscles in my arms grew numb from the weight of the pole. Little Anne's claws slipped again. I thought she was gone. At the very edge of the ice, she caught again. All I could see now were her small red paws and her nose and eyes. By old Dan's actions, I could tell he understood and wanted to help. He ran over close to my pole and started digging at the ice. I whopped him with the cane. That was the only time in my life I ever hit my dog. I had to get him out of the way so I could see what I was doing. Just when I thought my task was impossible, I felt the hook slide under the tough leather. It was none too soon. As gently as I could, I dragged her over the rim of the ice. At first I thought she was dead. She didn't move. Old Dan started whining and licking her face and ears. She moved her head. I started talking to her. She made an effort to stand, but couldn't. Her muscles were paralyzed, and the blood had long since ceased to flow. At the movement of little Anne, old Dan threw a fit. He started barking and jumping. His long red tail fanned the air. Still holding onto my pole, I tried to take a step backward. My feet wouldn't move. A cold, gripping fear came over me. I thought my legs were frozen. I made another effort to lift my leg. It moved. I realized that my feet were stuck in the soft, muddy bottom. I started backing out, dragging the body of my little dog. I couldn't feel the pole in my hands. When my feet touched the icy bank, I couldn't feel that either. All the feeling in my body was gone. I wrapped little Anne in my coat and hurried into my clothes. With the pole, I fished my light back. Close by was a large drift. I climbed up on top of it and dug a hole down through the ice and snow until I reached the dry limbs. I poured half of the oil in my lantern down into the hole and dropped in a match. In no time, I had a roaring fire. I laid little Anne close to the warm heat and went to work. Old Dan washed her head with his warm red tongue while I massaged and rubbed her body. I could tell by her cries when the blood started circulating. Little by little, her strength came back. I stood her on her feet and started walking her. She was weak and wobbly, but I knew she would live. I felt much better and breathed a sigh of relief. After drying myself out the best I could, I took the lantern handle from the pole, bent it back to its original position, and put it back on the lantern. Holding the light out in front of me, I looked at it. The bright metal gleamed in the firelight glow. I started talking to it. I said, "Thanks, old lantern, more than you'll ever know. I'll always take care of you. Your globe will always be clean, and there'll never be any rust or dirt on your frame." I knew if it had not been for the miracle of the lantern, my little dog would have met her death on that night. Her grave would have been the cold, icy waters of the Illinois River. Out in the river, I could hear the cold water gurgling in the icy trough. It seemed to be angry. It hissed and growled as it tore its way through the channel. I shuddered to think of what could have happened. Before I left for home, I walked back to the sycamore tree. Once again, I said a prayer. But this time the words were different. I didn't ask for a miracle. In every way a young boy could, I said thanks. My second prayer wasn't said with just words. All of my heart and soul was in it. On my way home, I decided not to say anything to my mother and father about little Anne's accident. I knew it would scare Mama and she might stop my hunting. Reaching our house, I didn't hang the lantern in its usual place. I took it to my room and set it in a corner with the handle standing up. The next morning, I started sneezing and came down with a terrible cold. I told Mama I'd gotten my feet wet. She scolded me a little and started doctoring me. For 3 days and nights, I stayed home. All this time, I kept checking the handle of the lantern. My sisters shook the house from the roof to the floor with their playing and romping, but the handle never did fall. I went to my mother and asked her if God answered prayers every time one was said. She smiled and said, "No, Billy, not every time. He only answers the ones that are said from the heart. You have to be sincere and believe in him." She wanted to know why I had asked. I said, "Oh, I just wondered and wanted to know." She came over and straightened my suspenders, saying, "That was a very nice question for my little Daniel Boone to ask." Bending over, she started kissing me. I finally squirmed away from her, feeling as wet as a dirt dauber's nest. My mother never could kiss me like a fella should be kissed. Before she was done, I was kissed all over. It always made me feel silly and baby-like. I tried to tell her that a coon hunter wasn't supposed to be kissed that way, but Mama never could understand things like that. I stomped out of the house to see how my dogs were. The fame of my dogs spread all over our part of the Ozarks. They were the best in the country. No coon hunter came into my grandfather's store with as many pelts as I did. Grandpa never overlooked an opportunity to brag. He told everyone the story of my dogs and the part he had played in getting them. Many was the time some farmer coming to our home would say, "Your grandpa was telling me you got 3 coons over in Peavine Hollow the other night." I would listen, knowing I only got one, or maybe none, but grandpa was my pal. If he said I caught 10 in one tree, it was just that way. Because of my grandfather's bragging and his firm belief in my dogs and me, a terrible thing happened. One morning, while having breakfast, Mama said to Papa, "I'm almost out of cornmeal. Do you think you can go to the mill today?" Papa said, "I intended to butcher a hog. We're about out of meat." Looking at me, he said, "Shell a sack of corn, take one of the mules, and go to the mill for your mother." With the help of my sisters, we shelled the corn. Throwing it over our mules' back, I started for the store. On arriving at the mill house, I tied my mule to the hitching post, took my corn, and set it by the door. I walked over to the store and told Grandpa I wanted to get some corn ground. He said,
"I'll be with you in just a minute."
As I was waiting, I heard a horse coming. Looking out, I saw who it was, and didn't like what I saw. It was the two youngest Pritchard boys. I had run into them on several occasions during pie suppers and dances. The Pritchards were a large family that lived upriver about 5 miles. As in most small country communities, there is one family that no one likes. The Pritchards were it. Tales were told that they were bootleggers, thieves, and just all around no accounts. The story had gone round that old man Pritchard had killed a man somewhere in Missouri before moving to our part of the country. Reuben was 2 years older than I, big and husky for his age. He never had much to say. He had mean-looking eyes that were set far back in his rugged face. They were smoky-hued and unblinking, as if the eyelids were paralyzed. I had heard that once he had cut a boy with a knife in a fight over at the sawmill. Rainey was the youngest, about my age. He had the meanest disposition of any boy I had ever known. Because of this, he was disliked by young and old. Wherever Rainey went, trouble seemed to follow. He was always wanting to bet, and would bet on anything. He was nervous and could never seem to stand still. Once at my grandfather's store, I had given him a piece of candy. Snatching it out of my hand, he ate it, and then sneered at me and said it wasn't any good. During a pie supper one night, he wanted to bet a dime that he could whip me. My mother told me always to be kind to Rainey, that he couldn't help being the way he was. I asked why. She said it was because his brothers were always picking on him and beating him. On entering the store, they stopped and glared at me. Reuben walked over to the counter. Rainey came over to me. Leering at me, he said, "I'd like to make a bet with you." I told him I didn't want to bet. He asked me if I was scared. "No, I just don't want to bet," I said. His neck and ears looked as though they hadn't been washed in months. His ferret-like eyes kept darting here and there. Glancing down to his hands, I saw the back of his right sleeve was stiff and starchy from the constant wiping of his nose. He saw I was looking him over and asked if I liked what I saw. I started to say no, but didn't. Turned and walked away a few steps. Reuben ordered some chewing tobacco.
"Aren't you a little young to be chewing?"
Grandpa asked.
"Ain't for me, it's for my dad," Reuben growled.
Grandpa handed two plugs to him. He paid for it, turned around, and handed one plug to Rainey. Holding the other up in front of him, he looked it over. Looking at Grandpa, he gnawed at one corner of it. Grandpa mumbled something about how kids were brought up these days. He came from behind the counter, saying to me,
"Let's go grind that corn."
The Pritchard boys made no move to follow us out of the store.
"Come on," Grandpa said. "I'm going to lock up till I get this corn ground."
"We'll just stay here. I want to look at some of the shirts," said Reuben.
"No, you won't," said Grandpa. "Come on, I'm going to lock up."
Begrudgingly, they walked out. I helped Grandpa start the mill, and we proceeded to grind the corn. The Pritchard boys had followed us and were standing looking on. Rainey walked over to me.
"I hear you have some good hounds," he said.
I told him I had the best in the country. If he didn't believe me, he could just ask my grandfather. He just leered at me.
"I don't think they're half as good as you say they are," he said. "Bet our old blue tick hound can out-hunt both of them."
I laughed.
"Ask Grandpa who brings in the most hides." "I wouldn't believe him. He's crooked," he said.
I let him know right quick that my grandfather wasn't crooked.
"He's a storekeeper, ain't he?" he said.
I glanced over at Grandpa. He had heard the remark made by Rainey. His friendly old face was as red as a turkey gobbler's wattle. The last of my corn was just going through the grinding stones. Grandpa pushed a lever to one side, shutting off the power. He came over and said to Rainey,
"What do you do? Just go around looking for trouble? What do you want, a fight?"
Reuben sidled over.
"This ain't none of your business," he said. "Besides, Rainey's not looking for a fight. We just want to make a bet with him."
Grandpa glared at Reuben.
"Any bet you would make sure would be a good one, all right. What kind of a bet?"
Reuben spat a mouthful of tobacco juice on the clean floor. He said, "Well, we've heard so much about them hounds of his, we just think it's a lot of talk and lies. We'd like to make a little bet. Say about $2.
I had never seen my old grandfather so mad. The red had left his face. In its place was a sickly, paste gray color. The kind old eyes behind the glasses burned with a fire I had never seen. In a loud voice, he asked, "Bet on what?"
Reuben spat again. Grandpa's eyes followed the brown stain in its arch until it landed on the clean floor and splattered. With a leering grin on his ugly, dirty face, Reuben said, "Well, we got an old coon up in our part of the country that's been there a long time. Ain't no dog yet ever been smart enough to tree him, and I..."
Rainey broke into the conversation.
"He ain't just an ordinary coon. He's an old-timer. Folks call him the ghost coon. Believe me, he is a ghost. He just runs hounds long enough to get them all warmed up, then climbs a tree and disappears. Our old blue hound has treed him more times than..."
Reuben told Rainey to shut up and let him do the talking. Looking over at me, he said,
"What do you say? Want to bet $2 your hounds can tree him?"
I looked at my grandfather, but he didn't help me. I told Reuben I didn't want to bet, but I was pretty sure my dogs could tree the ghost coon. Rainey butted in again.
"What's the matter, you yeller?"
I felt the hot blood rush into my face. My stomach felt like something alive was crawling in it. I doubled up my right fist and was on the point of hitting Rainey in one of his eyes when I felt my grandfather's hand on my shoulder. I looked up. His eyes flashed as he looked at me. A strange little smile was tugging at the corner of his mouth. The big artery in his neck was pounding out and in. It reminded me of a young bird that had fallen out of a nest and lay dying on the ground. Still looking at me, he reached back and took his billfold from his pocket, saying,
"Let's call that bet."
Turning to Reuben, he said,
"I'm going to let him call your bet, but now you listen. If you boys take him up there to hunt the ghost coon and jump on him and beat him up, you're sure going to hear from me. I don't mean maybe. I'll have both of you taken to Tahlequah and put in jail. You had better believe that."
Reuben saw he had pushed my grandfather far enough. Backing up a couple of steps, he said,
"We're not going to jump on him. All we want to do is make a bet."
Grandpa handed me two $1 bills, saying to Reuben, "You hold your money, and he can hold his. If you lose, you had better pay off." Looking back to me, he said,
"Son, if you lose, pay off."
I nodded my head. I asked Reuben when he wanted me to come up for the hunt. He thought a minute.
"You know where that old log slide comes out from the hills onto the road?" he asked.
I nodded.
"We'll meet you there tomorrow night, about dark," he said.
It was fine with me, I said, but I told him not to bring his hounds because mine wouldn't hunt with other dogs. He said he wouldn't. I agreed to bring my axe and lantern. As they turned to leave, Rainey smirked.
"Sucker,"
he said. I made no reply. After the Pritchard boys had gone, my grandfather looked at me and said,
"Son, I have never asked another man for much, but I sure want you to catch the ghost coon."
I told him if the ghost coon made one track in the river bottoms, my dogs would get him.
Grandpa laughed. "You better be getting home. It's getting late, and your mother's waiting for the cornmeal," he said.
I could hear him chuckling as he walked toward his store. I thought to myself, there goes the best grandpa a boy ever had. Lifting the sack of meal to the back of my old mule, I started for home. All the way I kept thinking of old Dan, little Ann, ghost coons, and the two ugly, dirty Pritchard boys. I decided not to tell my mother and father anything about the hunt, for I knew Mama wouldn't approve of anything I had to do with the Pritchards. The following evening, I arrived at the designated spot early. I sat down by a red oak tree to wait. I called little Ann over to me and had a good talk with her. I told her how much I loved her, scratched her back, and looked at the pads of her feet. "Sweetheart," I said, "you must do something for me tonight. I want you to tree the ghost coon, for it means so much to Grandpa and me."
She seemed to understand and answered by washing my face and hands. I tried to talk to old Dan, but I may as well have talked to a stump for all the attention he paid to me. He kept walking around, sniffing here and there. He couldn't understand why we were waiting. He was wanting to hunt. Reuben and Rainey showed up just at dark. Both had sneers on their faces. "Are you ready?" Reuben asked. "Yes," I said, and asked him which way was the best to go. "Let's go down river a way and work up," he said. "We're sure to strike him coming up river, and that way we got the wind in our favor." "Are these the hounds that we've been hearing so much about?" Rainey asked. I nodded. "They look too little to be any good," he said. I told him dynamite came in little packages. He asked me if I had my $2. "Yes," I said. He wanted to see my money. I showed it to him. Reuben, not to be outdone, showed me his. We crossed an old field and entered the river bottoms. By this time it was quite dark. I lit my lantern and asked which one wanted to carry my axe. "It's yours," Rainey said. "You carry it." Not wanting to argue, I carried both the lantern and the axe. Rainey started telling me how stingy and crooked my grandfather was. I told him I hadn't come to have any trouble or to fight. All I wanted to do was hunt the ghost coon. If there was going to be any trouble, I would just call my dogs and go home. Reuben had a nickel's worth of sense, but Rainey had none at all. Reuben told him if he didn't shut up, he was going to bloody his nose. That shut Rainey up. Old Dan opened up first. It was a beautiful thing to hear. The deep tones of his voice rolled in the silent night. A bird in a canebrake on our right started chirping. A big swamp rabbit came running down the riverbank as if all hell was close to his heels. A bunch of mallards feeding in the shallows across the river took flight with frightened quacks. A feeling that only a hunter knows slowly crept over my body. I whooped to my dogs, urging them on. Little Anne came in. Her bell-like tones blended with old Dan's in perfect rhythm. We stood and listened to the beautiful music, the deep-throated notes of hunting hounds on the hot-scented trail of a river coon. Reuben said, "If he crosses the river up at the Buck Ford, it's the ghost coon, as that's the way he always runs." We stood and listened. Sure enough, the voices of my dogs were silent for a few minutes. Old Dan, a more powerful swimmer than Little Anne, was the first to open up after crossing over. She was close behind him. Reuben said, "That's him, all right. That's the ghost coon." They crossed the river again. We waited. Rainey said, "You may as well get your money out now." I told him just to wait a while, and I'd show him the ghost coon's hide. This brought a loud laugh from Rainey, which sounded like someone had dropped an empty bucket on a gravel bar and then had kicked it. The wily old coon crossed the river several times, but couldn't shake my dogs from his trail. He cut out from the bottoms, walked a rail fence, and jumped from it into a thick canebrake. He piled into an old slough. Where it emptied into the river, he swam to the middle. Doing opposite to what most coons do, which is swim downstream, he swam upstream. He stopped in an old drift in the middle of it. Little Anne found him. When she jumped him from the drift, old Dan was far downriver searching for the trail. If he could have gotten there in time, it would have been the last of the ghost coon, but little Ann couldn't do much by herself in the water. He fought his way free from her, swam to our side, and ran upstream. I could hear old Dan coming through the bottoms on the other side, bawling at every jump. I could feel the driving power in his voice. We heard him when he hit the water to cross over. It sounded like a cow had jumped in. Little Anne was warming up the ghost coon. I could tell by her voice that she was close to him. Reaching our side, old Dan tore out after her. He was a mad hound. His deep voice was telling her he was coming. We were trotting along, following my dogs, when I heard Little Anne's bawling stop. "Wait a minute," I said. "I think she has treed him. Let's give her time to circle the tree to make sure he's there." Old Dan opened up bawling treed. Reuben started on. "Something's wrong," I said. "I can't hear Little Anne." Rainey spoke up. "Maybe the ghost coon ate her up." I glared at him. Hurrying on, we came to my dogs. Old Dan was bawling at a hole in a large sycamore that had fallen into the river. At that spot, the bank was a good 10 feet above the water level. As the big tree had fallen, the roots had been torn and twisted from the ground. The jagged roots, acting as a drag, had stopped it from falling all the way into the stream. The trunk lay on a deep slant from the top of the bank to the water.
Looking down, I could see the broken, tangled mass of the top. Debris from floods had caught in the limbs, forming a drift. Old Dan was trying to dig and gnaw his way into the log. Pulling him from the hole, I held my lantern up and looked down into the dark hollow. I knew that somewhere down below the surface, there had to be another hole in the trunk, as water had filled the hollow to the river level. Reuben, looking over my shoulder, said, "That coon couldn't be in there. If he was, he'd be drowned." I agreed. Rainey spoke up. "You ready to pay off?" he asked. "I told you them hounds couldn't tree the ghost coon." I told him the show wasn't over. Little Ann had never bald treed, and I knew she wouldn't until she knew exactly where the coon was. Working the bank up and down, not finding the trail, she swam across the river and worked the other side. For a good half hour, she searched that side before she came back across to where old Dan was. She sniffed around the hollow log.
"We might as well get away from here," Rainey said. "They ain't going to find the ghost coon." "It sure looks that way," Reuben said.
I told them I wasn't giving up until my dogs did.
"You just want to be stubborn," Reuben said. "I'm ready for my money now."
I asked him to wait a few minutes.
"Ain't no use," he said. "No hound yet ever treed that ghost coon."
Hearing a whine, I turned around. Little Anne had crawled up on the log and was inching her way down the slick trunk toward the water. I held my lantern up so I could see better. Spraddle-legged, claws digging into the bark, she was easing her way down.
"You better get her out of there," Reuben said. "If she gets down in that old treetop, she'll drown."
Reuben didn't know my little Anne. Once her feet slipped, I saw her hindquarters fall off to one side. She didn't get scared. Slowly, she eased her legs back up on the log. I made no reply. I just watched and waited. Little Anne eased herself into the water. Swimming to the drift, she started sniffing around. In places, it was thin, and her legs would break through. Climbing, clawing, and swimming, she searched the drift over, looking for the lost trail. I saw when she stopped searching. With her body half in the water and her front feet curved over a piece of driftwood, she turned her head and looked toward the shore. I could see her head twisting from side to side. I could tell by her actions that she had gotten the scent. With a low whine, she started back. I told Reuben, "I think she smells something." Slowly and carefully, she worked her way through the tangled mass. I lost sight of her when she came close to the undermined bank. She wormed her way under the overhang. I could hear her clawing and wallowing around. And then all hell broke loose. Out from under the bank came the biggest coon I had ever seen, the ghost coon. He came out right over little Ann. She caught him in the old treetop. I knew she was no match for him in that tangled mass of limbs and logs. He fought his way free and swam for the opposite bank. She was right behind him. Old Dan didn't wait, look, or listen. He piled off the 10-foot bank and disappeared from sight. I looked for him. I knew he was tangled in the debris under the surface. I started to take off my overalls, but stopped when I saw his red head shoot up out of the water. Bawling and clawing his way free of the limbs and logs, he was on his way. On reaching midstream, the ghost coon headed downriver with little Ann still on his trail. We ran down the riverbank. I could see my dogs clearly in the moonlight. The ghost coon was about 15 feet ahead of little Ann. About 25 yards behind them came old Dan, trying so hard to catch up. I whooped to them. Reuben grabbed a pole, saying, "He may come out on this side." Knowing the ghost coon was desperate, I wondered what he would do. Reaching a gravel bar below the high bank, we ran out on it to the water's edge. Then the ghost coon did something that I never expected. Coming even with us, he turned from midstream and came straight for us. I heard Reuben yell, "Here he comes!" He churned his way through the shallows and ran right between us. Reuben swung his pole, missed the coon, and almost hit little Ann. The coon headed for the river bottoms with her right on his heels. The bawling of little Ann and our screaming and hollering made so much noise I didn't hear old Dan coming. He tore out of the river, plowed into me, and knocked me down. We ran through the bottoms, following my dogs. I thought the ghost coon was going back to the sycamore log, but he didn't. He ran upriver. While hurrying after them, I looked over at Rainey. For once in his life, I think he was excited. He was whooping and screaming and falling over logs and limbs. I felt good all over. Glancing over at me, Rainey said, "They ain't got him yet." The ghost coon crossed the river time after time. Seeing that he couldn't shake old Dan and little Ann from his trail, he cut through the river bottoms and ran out into an old field. At this maneuver, Reuben said to Rainey, "He's heading for that tree."
"What tree?" I asked.
"You'll see," Rainey said. "When he gets tired, he always heads for that tree. That's where he gets his name, the Ghost Coon. He just disappears."
"If he disappears, my dogs will disappear with them," I said.
Rainey laughed.
I had to admit one thing. The Pritchard boys knew the habits of the Ghost Coon. I knew he couldn't run all night. He had already far surpassed any coon I had ever chased.
"They're just about there," Reuben said.
Just then I heard old Dan bark treed. I waited for little Ann's voice. I didn't hear her. I wondered what it could be this time.
"He's there, all right," Reuben said. "He's in that tree."
"Well, come on," I said. "I want to see that tree."
"You might as well get your money out," Rainey said.
I told him he had said that once before, back on the riverbank. Coming up to the tree, I could see it was a huge bur oak. It wasn't tall, it was just the opposite, rather low and squatty. The top was a thick mass of large limbs, and it hadn't shed all of its leaves yet. It stood by itself in an old field. There were no other trees within 50 yards of it. About 15 feet to the left were the remains of a barbed wire fence, an old gate hung by one rusty hinge from a large corner post. I could tell that at one time a house had stood close by. Reuben saw me looking around.
"Long time ago, some Indians lived here and farmed these fields," he said.
I walked around the tree looking for the coon, but could see very little in the dark shadows.
"Ain't no use to look," Reuben said. "He won't be there."
Rainey spoke up.
"This ain't the first time we've been to this tree," he said.
Reuben told Rainey to shut up.
"You talk too much," he said. In a whining voice, Rainey said, "Reuben, you know the coon ain't in that tree. Make him pay off him. Let's go home. I'm getting tired."
I told Reuben I was going to climb the tree.
"Go ahead," he said. "It won't do you any good."
The tree was easy to climb. I looked all over it, on each limb and in every dark place. I looked for a hollow. The ghost coon wasn't there. I climbed back down, scolded old Dan to stop his loud bawling, and looked for little Ann. I saw her far up the old fence row, sniffing and running here and there. I knew the ghost coon had pulled a real trick, but I couldn't figure out what it was. Little Ann had never yet barked treed. I knew if the coon was in the tree, she wouldn't still be searching for a trail. Old Dan started working again. My dogs covered the field. They circled and circled. They ran up and down the barbed wire fence on both sides. I knew the coon hadn't walked the barbed wire, ghost or no ghost. He couldn't do that. I walked over to the old gate and looked around. I sat down and stared up into the tree. Little Ann came to me. Old Dan, giving up his search, came back to the tree and bawled a couple of times. I scolded him again. Reuben came over, leering at me. He said,
"You give up?"
I didn't answer. Little Ann once again started searching for the lost trail. Old Dan went to help her. Rainey said,
"I told you that you couldn't tree the ghost coon. Why don't you pay off so we can go home?"
I told him I hadn't given up. My dogs were still hunting. When they gave up, I would too.
Reuben said, "Well, we're not going to stay here all night."
Looking back to the tree, I thought perhaps I had overlooked something. I told Reuben I was going to climb it again. He laughed.
"Go ahead. Won't do any good. You climbed it once. Ain't you satisfied?"
"No, I'm not satisfied," I said. "I just don't believe in ghost coons."
Reuben said, "I don't believe in ghosts either, but facts are facts. To tell you the truth, I've climbed that tree a dozen times, and there just ain't no place in it for a coon to hide."
Rainey spoke up. "Our old blue hound has treed the ghost coon in this tree more times than one. Maybe you two don't believe in ghosts, but I do.
Why don't you pay off so we can get away from here?"
"I'll climb it one more time," I said. "If I can't find him, I'll pay off." Climbing up again, I searched and searched. When I got through, I knew the ghost coon wasn't in that tree. When I came down, I saw my dogs had given up. That took the last resistance out of me. I knew if they couldn't find the ghost coon, I couldn't. Digging the two $1 bills out of my pocket, I walked over to Reuben. Little Ann was by my side. I handed my money over, saying, "Well, you won it fair and square." With a grin on his face, Reuben took my money. He said,
"I bet this'll break your old grandpa's heart."
I didn't reply. Reaching down, I caught little Anne's head in my hands. Looking into her warm, friendly eyes, I said, "It's all right, little girl. We haven't given up yet. We'll come back. We may never catch the ghost coon, but we'll run him until he leaves the country." She licked my hands and whined. A small breeze began to stir. Glancing up into the tree, I saw some leaves shaking. I said to Reuben, "Looks like the wind is coming up. It may blow up a storm. We'd better be heading for home." Just as I turned, I saw little Anne throw up her head and whine. Her body grew stiff and taut. I watched her. She was testing the wind. I knew she had scented something in the breeze. Stiff-legged, head high in the air, she started walking toward the tree. Almost there, she turned back and stopped. I knew she had caught the scent, but could only catch it when the breeze came. Looking at Reuben, I said, "I haven't lost that $2 yet." Another breeze drifted out of the river bottoms. Little Anne caught the scent again. Slowly, she walked straight to the large gatepost, reared up on it with her front feet, and bawled the most beautiful tree bark I ever heard in my life. Old Dan, not understanding why little Anne was bawling, stood and looked. He walked over to the post, reared up on it, and sniffed. Then, raising his head, he shook the dead leaves in the bur oak tree with his deep voice. I looked at Rainey. Laughing, I said, "There's your ghost, coon. Now what do you think of my dogs?" For once, he made no reply. Going over to the post, I saw it was a large black locust put there many years ago to hang the gate. Looking up at the tree, I saw how the ghost coon had pulled his trick. One large, long limb ran out and hung directly over the gate. It was a drop of a good 12 feet from the branch to the top of the gatepost, but I knew we weren't after an ordinary coon. This was the ghost coon. I said to Reuben, "Boost me up, and I'll see if the post is hollow." After breaking off a long jimson weed to use as a prod, I got up on Reuben's shoulder, and he raised me up. The post was hollow. Not knowing how far down the hole went, I started the switch down. About halfway, I felt something soft. I gave it a hard jab. I heard him coming. He boiled out right in my face. I let go of everything. Hitting the ground, I rolled over on my back and looked up. For a split second, the ghost coon stayed on top of the post, and then he jumped. My dogs were on him the instant he hit the ground. The fight was on. I knew the coon didn't have a chance, as he wasn't in the waters of the river. He didn't give up easily, even though he was on dry land. He was fighting for his life, and a good account he gave. He fought his way to freedom and made it back to the bur oak tree. He was a good 6 feet up the side when old Dan, leaping high in the air, caught him and pulled him back down. At the foot of the tree, the fight went on. Again, the ghost coon fought his way free. This time, he made it and disappeared in the dark shadows of the tree. Old Dan was furious. Never before had I seen a coon get away from him. I told Reuben I would climb up and run him out. As I started climbing, I saw little Ann go to one side and old Dan to the other. My dogs would never stay together when they had treed a coon, so that any way he left a tree, he was met by one of them. About halfway up, far out on a limb, I found the ghost coon. As I started toward him, my dog stopped bawling. I heard something I had heard many times. The sound was like the cry of a small baby. It was the cry of a ringtail coon when he knows it is the end of the trail. I never liked to hear this cry, but it was all in the game, the hunter and the hunted. As I sat there on the limb, looking at the old fella, he cried again. Something came over me. I didn't want to kill him. I hollered down and told Reuben I didn't want to kill the ghost coon. He hollered back, "Are you crazy?" I told him I wasn't crazy, I just didn't want to kill him. I climbed down. Reuben was mad. He said, "What's the matter with you?" "Nothing," I told him. "I just don't have the heart to kill the coon." I told him there were plenty more. Why kill him? He had lived here a long time, and more than one hunter had listened to the voices of his hounds bawling on his trail. Rainey said, "He's chicken liver, that's what it is." I didn't like that, but not wanting to argue, I didn't say anything. Reuben said, "I'll go up and run him out." "I won't let my dogs kill him," I said. Reuben glared at me. "I'm going up and run that coon out," he said. "If you stop your dogs, I'm going to beat you half to death." "Do it anyway, Reuben," Rainey said. "I've a good mind to," said Reuben. Just as Reuben started to climb the tree, old Dan growled. He was staring into the darkness. Something was coming. "What's that?" I asked. "I don't know," Reuben said. "Don't sound like anything I ever heard." "It's ghosts," Rainey said. "Let's get away from here." An animal was coming out of the darkness.
It was walking slowly in an odd way, as if it were walking sideways. The hair on the back of my neck stood straight out. As the animal came closer, Rainey said, "Why, it's Old Blue. How did he get loose?" It was a big blue tick hound. Around his neck was a piece of rope about 3 feet long. One could see that the rope had been gnawed in two. The frayed end had become entangled in a fair-sized dead limb. Dragging the limb was what made the dog look so odd. I felt much better when I found out what it was. The blue tick hound was like the Pritchards, mean and ugly. He was a big dog, tall and heavy. His chest was thick and solid. He came up growling. The hair on his back was standing straight up. He walked stiff-legged around old Dan, showing his teeth. I told Rainey he had better get hold of his dog, or there was sure to be a fight. "You better get hold of your dog," he said. "I'm not worried about Old Blue. He can take care of himself." I said no more. "Don't make no difference now whether you kill a ghost coon or not," Reuben said. "Old Blue'll take care of him." I knew the killing of the coon was out of my control, but I didn't want to see him die. I said to Reuben, "Just give back my $2 and I'll go home. I can't keep you from killing him, but I don't have to stay and see it."
"Reuben, don't give him the money," Rainey said. "He ain't killed the ghost coon." "That's right," Reuben said. "You ain't, and I wouldn't let you now, even if you wanted to."
I told them my dogs had treed the ghost coon, and that was the bet, to tree the ghost coon.
"No, it wasn't," Reuben said. "You said you would kill him."
"It was no such thing," I said. "I done all I said I would." Reuben walked up in front of me. He said,
"I ain't gonna give you the money. You didn't win it fair. Now, what are you gonna do about it?"
I looked into his mean eyes. I started to make some reply, but decided against it. He saw my hesitation and said,
"You better get your dogs and get out of here before you get whipped."
In a loud voice, Rainey said,
"Bloody his nose, Reuben."
I was scared. I couldn't whip Reuben. He was too big for me. I started to turn and leave when I thought of what my grandfather had told them. "You had better remember what my grandpa said," I reminded them. "He'll do just what he said he would." Reuben didn't hit me, he just grabbed me, and with his brute strength threw me down on the ground. He had me on my back with my arms outspread. He had a knee on each arm. I made no effort to fight back. I was scared.
"If you say one word to your grandpa about this," Reuben said, "I'll catch you hunting some night and take my knife to you."
Looking up into his ugly face, I knew he would do just what he said. I told him to let me up and I would go and not say anything to anyone.
"Don't let him up, Reuben," Rainey said. "Beat the hell out of him, or hold him and let me do it."
Just then I heard growling and a commotion off to one side. The blue hound had finally gotten a fight out of old Dan. Turning my head sideways, I could see them standing on their hind legs, tearing and slashing at each other. The weight of the big hound pushed old Dan over. I told Reuben to let me up so we could stop the fight. He laughed.
"While my dog is whipping yours, I think I'll just work you over a little."
So saying, he jerked my cap off and started whipping me in the face with it. I heard Rainey yell,
"Reuben, they're killing Old Blue!"
Reuben jumped up off me. I clambered up and looked over to the fight. What I saw thrilled me. Faithful little Ann, bitch though she was, had gone to the assistance of old Dan. I knew my dogs were very close to each other. Everything they did was done as a combination, but I never expected this. It is a very rare occasion for a bitch dog to fight another dog, but fight she did. I could see that little Ann's jaws were glued to the throat of the big hound. She would never loosen that deadly hold until the last breath of life was gone. Old Dan was tearing and slashing at the soft belly. I knew the destruction his long, sharp teeth were causing. Again, Rainey yelled,
"Reuben, they're killing him! They're killing Old Blue! Do something quick!"
Reuben darted over to one side, grabbed my axe from the ground, and said in a loud voice,
"I'll kill them damn hounds!"
At the thought of what he was going to do with the axe, I screamed and ran for my dogs. Reuben was about 10 feet ahead of me, bent over, running with the axe held out in front of him. I knew I could never get to them in time. I was screaming, "No, Reuben, no!" I saw the small stick where it whipped up from the ground. As if it were alive, it caught between Reuben's legs. I saw him fall. I ran on by. Reaching the dogfight, I saw the big hound was almost gone. He had long since ceased fighting. His body lay stretched full length on the ground. I grabbed old Dan's collar and pulled him back.
It was different with little Ann. Pull as I might, she wouldn't let go of the hound's throat. Her jaws were locked. I turned old Dan loose, and getting a straddle of little Ann, I pried her jaws apart with my hands. Old Dan had darted back in. Grabbing his collar again, I pulled them off to one side. The blue hound lay where he was. I thought perhaps he was already dead, and then I saw him move a little. Still holding my dogs by their collars, I looked back. I couldn't understand what I saw. Reuben was laying where he had fallen. His back was toward me, and his body was bent in a U shape. Rainey was standing on the other side of him, staring down. I hollered and asked Rainey, "What's the matter?" He didn't answer. He just stood as though in a trance, staring down at Reuben. I hollered again. He still didn't answer. I didn't know what to do. I couldn't turn my dogs loose. They would go for the hound again. Again I hollered at Rainey, asking him to come and help me. He neither moved nor answered. I had to do something. Looking around, my glance fell on the old barbed wire fence. I led my dogs to it. Holding onto their collars with one hand, I worked a rusty barbed wire backwards and forwards against a staple until it broke. Running the end of it under their collars, I tied them up. They made two or three lunges toward the hound, but the wire held. I walked over and stopped at Rainey's side. I again asked, "What's the matter?" He said not a word. I could see that Rainey was paralyzed with fright. His mouth and eyes were open wide, and his face was as white as chalk. I laid my hand on his shoulder. At the touch of my hand, he jumped and screamed. Still screaming, he turned and started running. I watched him until he disappeared in the darkness. Looking down at Reuben, I saw what had paralyzed Rainey. When Reuben had tripped, he had fallen on the axe. As it entered his stomach, the sharp blade had sunk to the eye of the double-bitted axe. Turning my back to the horrible sight, I closed my eyes. The muscles in my stomach knotted and jerked. A nauseating sickness spread over my body. I couldn't look at him. I heard Reuben whisper. Turning around, I knelt down by his side with my back to the axe. I couldn't understand what he was whispering. Kneeling down closer, I heard and understood. In a faint voice, he said, "Take it out of me." I hesitated. Again, he pleaded, "Please, take it out of me." Turning around, I saw his hands were curled around the protruding blade as if he himself had tried to pull it from his stomach. How I did it, I'll never know. Putting my hands over his and pressing down, I pulled the axe from the wound. The blood gushed. I felt the warm heat as it spread over my hands. Again, the sickness came over me. I stumbled to my feet and stepped back a few paces. Seeing a movement from Reuben, I thought he was going to get up. With his hands, he pushed himself halfway up. His eyes were wide open, staring straight at me. Stopping in his effort of getting up, still staring at me, his mouth opened as if to say something. Words never came. Instead, a large red bubble slowly worked its way out of his mouth and burst. He fell back to the ground. I knew he was dead. Scared, not knowing what to do, I called for Rainey. I got no answer. I called his name again and again. I could get no reply. My voice echoed in the darkness of the silent night. A cold chill ran over my body. I suppose it is natural at a time like that for a boy to think of his mother. I thought of mine. I wanted to get home. Going over to my dogs, I glanced to where the blue hound was. He was trying to get up. I was glad he wasn't dead. Picking up my lantern, I thought of my axe. I left it. I didn't care if I never saw it again. Knowing I couldn't turn my dogs loose, I broke off enough of the wire to lead them. As I passed under the branches of the bur oak tree, I looked up into the dark foliage. I could see the bright eyes of the ghost coon. Everything that had happened on this terrible night was because of his very existence, but it wasn't his fault. I also knew he was a silent witness to the horrible scene. Behind me lay the still body of a young boy. On my left, a blue tick hound lay torn and bleeding. Even after all that had happened, I could feel no hatred for the ghost coon, and was not sorry I had let him live. Arriving home, I awakened my mother and father. Starting at my grandfather's mill, I told everything that had happened. I left nothing out. My mother had started crying long before I had completed my story. Papa said nothing, just sat and listened. When I had finished, he kept staring down at the floor in deep thought. I could hear the sobbing of my mother in the silence. I walked over to her. She put her arms around me and said, "My poor little boy." Getting to his feet, Papa reached for his coat and hat. Mama asked him where he was going.
"Well, I have to go up there," he said. "I'm going to get Grandpa, for he's the only man in the country that has authority to move the body."
Looking at me, he said,
"You go across the river, get old man Lowry, and you may as well go on up and tell the Bufords, too. Tell them to meet us at your grandfather's place."
I hurried to carry the sad message.
The following day was a nasty one. A slow, cold drizzle had set in. Feeling trapped indoors, I prowled from room to room. I couldn't understand why my father hadn't come back from the Pritchards.
I sat by the window and watched the road. Understanding my feelings, Mama said, "Billy, I wouldn't worry. He'll be back before long. It takes time for things like that."
"I know," I said, "but you would think he would have been back by now."
Time dragged slowly by. Late in the afternoon, I saw Papa coming. Our old mule was jogging along. Water was shooting out from under his feet in small squirts at every step. Papa had tied the halter rope around the mule's neck. He was sitting, humped over, with his hands jammed deep in the pockets of his patched and worn mackinaw. I felt sorry for him. He was soaking wet, tired, sleepy, and hungry. Telling Mama, "Here he is," I grabbed my jumper and cap and ran out to the gate and waited. I was going to ask him what had happened at the Pritchards, but on seeing his tired face and wet clothes, I said, "Papa, you had better go into the fire. I'll take care of the mule and do the feeding and milking."
"That would be fine," he said.
After doing the chores, I hurried to the house. I couldn't wait any longer. I had to find out what had happened. Walking into the front room, I saw my father had changed clothes. He was standing in front of the fireplace, drinking coffee.
"Boy, that's bad weather, isn't it?"
he said. I said it was, and asked him about Reuben.
"We went to the old tree and got Reuben's body," Papa said. "We were on our way back to the Pritchards when we met them. They were just this side of their place. They had started to look for him. Rainey had been so dazed when he got home, they couldn't make out what he was trying to tell them, but they knew it must have been something bad. They wanted to know what had happened. I did my best to explain the accident. It hit old man Pritchard pretty hard. I felt sorry for him."
Mama asked how Mrs. Pritchard was taking it. Papa said he didn't know, as he never did get to see any of the women folks. He said they were the funniest bunch he had ever seen. Couldn't understand them. There wasn't one tear shed that he could see. All of the men had stayed out at the barn. They never had been invited in for a cup of coffee or anything. Mama asked when they were to have the funeral.
"They have their own graveyard right there on the place," Papa said. "Old man Pritchard said they would take care of everything and didn't want to bother people. He said it was too far for anyone to come, and it was bad weather, too."
Mama said she couldn't help feeling sorry for Mrs. Pritchard and wished they were more friendly. I asked Papa about Rainey.
Papa said, "According to what old man Pritchard said, Rainey just couldn't seem to get over the shock. They were figuring on taking him into town to see the doctor."
In a stern voice, Papa said,
"Billy, I don't want you fooling around with the Pritchards any more. You have plenty of country around here, so you don't have to go there to hunt."
I said I wouldn't. I felt bad about the death of Reuben. I didn't feel like hunting and kept having bad dreams. I couldn't forget the way he had looked at me just before he died. I moped and wandered around in a daze. I wanted to do something, but didn't know what it was. I explained my feelings to my mother. She said, "Billy, I feel the same way and would like to do something to help, but I guess there's nothing we can do. There are people like the Pritchards all through the hills. They live in little worlds of their own and are all alone. They don't like to have outsiders interfere." I told my mother I had been thinking about how dangerous it was to carry an axe while hunting, and I had decided I'd save a few coon hides and get a good gun.
Boy, I just shouldn't have mentioned getting a gun. My mother got sitting hen mad.
"You're not getting a gun," she said. "I won't have that at all. I told you a long time ago you could have one when you are 21 years old, and I mean just that. I worry enough with you out there in the hills all hours of the night running and jumping, but I couldn't stand it if I knew you had a gun with you. No, sir. You can just forget about a gun."
"Yes, Mama," I said, and sulked off to my room.
Lying on my bed, still trying to figure out what I could do to help, I glanced over to the wall. There, tied in a small bundle, was just what I needed. Some time back, my sisters had made some flowers for decoration day. They had given me a small bouquet for my room. Taking them down, I could see they had faded a little and looked rather old, but they were still pretty. I blew the dust off and straightened the crinkled petals. Putting them inside my shirt, I left the house. I hadn't gone far when I heard something behind me. It was my dogs. I tried to tell them I wasn't going hunting. I just had a little business to attend to, and if they would go back, I'd take them out that night. It was no use. They couldn't understand. Circling around through the flats, I came to the hollow above the Pritchard's place. Down below me, I could see the graveyard and the fresh mound of dirt. As quietly as I could, I started easing myself down the mountainside. Old Dan loosened a rock. The further it bounced, the louder it got. It slammed up against a post oak tree and sounded like a gunshot. I held my breath and watched the house. No one came out. I glared at old Dan. He wagged his tail, and just to show off, he sat down on his rear and started digging at a flea with his hind leg. The way his leg was thumping in the leaves, anyone could have heard it for a mile. I waited until he quit thumping before starting on. Reaching the bottom, I had about 20 yards of clearing to cross, but the grass and bushes were pretty thick. Laying down on my stomach, with my heart beating like a trip hammer, I wiggled my way to Reuben's grave. I laid the flowers on the fresh mound of earth, and then turned round and scooted for the timber. Just as we reached the mountaintop, my foot slipped, and I kicked loose a large rock. Down the side of the mountain it rolled. This time the blue tick hound heard the noise. He came out from under the house, bawling. I heard a door slam, and Mrs. Pritchard came out. She stood, looking this way and that way. The hound ran up to the graveyard and started sniffing and bawling. Mrs. Pritchard followed him. Seeing the flowers on Reuben's grave, she picked them up and looked at them. She scolded the hound and then looked up at the hillside. I knew she couldn't see me because the timber was too thick, but I felt uncomfortable anyway. Scolding the hound again, she knelt down and arranged the flowers on the grave. Taking one more look at the hillside, she started back. Halfway to the house, I saw her reach down and gather the long cotton skirt in her hand and dab at her eyes. I felt much better after paying my respects to Reuben. Everything looked brighter, and I didn't have that funny feeling anymore. All the way home, my dogs kept running out in front of me. They would stop, turn around, and look at me. I had to smile, for I knew what they wanted. I stopped and petted them a little and told them that as soon as I got home and had my supper, we would go hunting. A few days later, on his way back from the mill, one of the Hatfield boys stopped at our place. He told me my grandfather wanted to see me. It was unusual for Grandpa to send for me, and it had me worried. I figured that he wanted to talk to me about the death of Reuben Pritchard. I always enjoyed talking to my Grandpa, but I didn't want to talk about Reuben's death. Every time I thought of him, I lived the horrible tragedy all over again. After a practically sleepless night, the next morning I started for the store. I was walking along deep in thought when little Anne zipped by me. She was as happy as a young gray squirrel. She wiggled and twisted, and once she barked at me. I looked behind me. There was old Dan trotting along. He stopped when I turned around. Little Anne came up to me. I scolded them and tried to explain that I wasn't going hunting. I was just going up to the store to see what my grandpa wanted. They couldn't or didn't want to understand. I picked up a small stick and slapped my leg with it. In a deep voice, I said, "Now you go home, or I'm going to wear you out." This hurt their feelings. With their tails between their legs and trotting side by side, they started back. Every little way, they would stop and look back at me. It was too much. I couldn't stand it. I began to feel bad all over. "Well, all right," I said. "Come on, you can go. But, Dan, if there are any dogs around the store and you get in a fight, I won't take you hunting for a whole year, and I mean that," although I knew I didn't. They came running, tickled to death. Little Anne took one of her silly spells. She started nipping at the long red tail of old Dan. Not getting any reaction from him, she jumped over him. She barked at him. He wouldn't even look at her. She ran around in front of him, laid down in the trail, acting like a cat ready to spring. Stiff-legged, he walked up close to her, stopped,
and showed his teeth. I laughed out loud. I knew he wouldn't bite her any more than he would bite me. He was just acting tough because he was a boy dog. After several attempts to get him to play, little Anne gave up. Together, they started sniffing around in the underbrush. As I walked up in front of the store, Grandpa hollered at me from the barn. I went over to him. Right away, he wanted to know all about Reuben's accident. He listened while I told the story over again. After I had had my say, Grandpa stood looking down at the ground. There was a deep frown on his face and a hurt look in his eyes. His quietness made me feel uneasy. He finally raised his head and looked at me. What I could see in his friendly old face tore at my heart. It seemed that there were more wrinkles than I had ever seen before. His uncombed iron-gray hair looked almost white. I noticed that his wrinkled old hand trembled as he rubbed the wire-stiff stubble on his chin. In a low voice that quivered as he talked, he said, "Billy, I'm sorry about all this, truly sorry. I can't help but feel that, in a way, it was my fault."
"No, Grandpa," I said, "it wasn't your fault. It wasn't anyone's fault. It just happened, and no one could help it."
"I know," he said, "but if I hadn't called Reuben's bet, nothing would have happened. I guess when a man gets old, he doesn't think straight. I shouldn't have let those boys get under my skin."
"Grandpa," I said, "Reuben and Rainey could get under anybody's skin. You couldn't help that. Why, they get under everyone's skin that gets close to them."
"Yes, I know," he said, "but still, I acted like a fool. Billy, I had no idea things were going to turn out like they did, or I wouldn't have called that bet."
Wanting to change the conversation, I said, "Grandpa, we won that bet fair and square, but they took my money anyway."
I saw the fire come back to his eyes. This made me feel better. He was more like the grandpa I loved.
"That's all right," he said. "We'll just forget the whole thing."
He stepped over and laid his hand on my shoulder. In a solemn voice, he said, "We won't talk about this again. Now, I want you to forget it ever happened because it wasn't your fault. Oh, I know it's hard for a boy to ever completely forget something like that. All through your life, you'll think of it now and then, but try not to let it bother you, and don't ever feel guilty about it. It's not good for a young boy to feel that way." I nodded my head, thinking if people would just stop questioning me about Reuben's death, maybe I could forget. Grandpa said,
"Well, the accident wasn't the only thing I wanted to talk to you about. I've got something else, something I think will help us both forget a lot of things."
The twinkle in Grandpa's eyes reminded me of what my father had said.
"Seems like that old man can cook up more deals than anyone in the country."
I didn't care how many deals Grandpa cooked up, he was still the best grandpa in the whole wide world. "What have you got?" I asked.
"Come over to the store," he said, "and I'll show you."
On our way over, I heard him mutter, "I hope this doesn't turn out like the ghost coon hunt."
On entering the store, Grandpa walked to the post office department and came back with a newspaper in his hand. He spread it out on the counter. Pointing with his finger, he said in a loud voice,
"Look there."
I looked. The large black letters read, "Championship Coon Hunt to be held." My eyes popped open. Again, I read the words. Grandpa was chuckling. I said, "Boy, if that isn't something, a championship coon hunt." Wide-eyed, I asked, "Where are they having this hunt, and what does it have to do with us?" Grandpa was getting excited. Off came his glasses, and out came the old red handkerchief. He blew his breath on the lens and polished them. He snorted a time or two, reared back, and almost shouted,
"Do with us? Why, it has everything to do with us. All my life I've wanted to go to one of these big coon hunts. Why, I've even dreamed about it. And now the opportunity has come. Yes, sir. Now I can go."
He paused.
"That is, if it's all right with you."
I was dumbfounded. I said, "All right with me? Why, Grandpa, you know it's all right with me, but what have I got to do with it?" Grandpa was so excited, I thought he was going to burst a blood vessel. Talking excitedly, he said,
"I've got it all fixed, Billy. We can enter old Dan and little Ann in this championship hunt."
I was so surprised at what Grandpa had said, I couldn't utter a word. At first, I was scared. And then a wonderful feeling came over me. I felt the excitement of the big hunt as it burned its way into my body. I started breathing like I had been running for 100 miles. After several attempts, I croaked, "Can just any dog be in this hunt?" Grandpa almost jumped as he answered,
"No, sir, not just any hound can be entered. They have to be the best, and they have to be registered, too."
He started talking with his hands. Pointing to a chair, he said,
"Sit down, and I'll tell you all about it."
Grandpa calmed down a little and started talking in a serious voice. "Billy," he said,
"it takes some doing to have a set of dogs entered in this hunt. I've been working on this for months. I've written letters on top of letters. I've even had several good friends in town helping me. You see, I've kept a record of all the coons your dogs have caught, and believe me, that catches up there with the best of them. Now, I have already paid the entry fee, and everything is fixed. All we have to do is go."
"Entry fee? How much did it cost?" I asked.
"You let me worry about that," he said. "Now, what do you say? Want to give it a whirl? I understand the winner receives a gold cup, and you never can tell. We might come home with it. We have as good a chance as anyone else."
Grandpa had me so worked up by this time, I didn't think anyone else had any good hounds but me. I reared back and blurted, "It's all right with me, Grandpa. Just tell me what to do." Grandpa flew out of gear like a Model T Ford. He slapped the counter with his hand. In a pent-up voice, he said,
"That's the boy. That's the way I like to hear a coon hunter talk."
With a questioning look on his face, he asked,
"Didn't I see your dogs with you when you came up?"
"Yes, they followed me," I said. "They're outside."
"Well, call them in," he said. "I got something for them."
I called to them. Little Ann came in the store, walking like she was scared. Old Dan came to the door and stopped. I tried to coax him in. It was no use. My dogs, never being allowed in the house, were scared to come in. Grandpa walked over to a hoop of cheese and cut off 2 chunks about the size of my fist. He walked to the door, talking to old Dan.
"What's the matter, boy?" he said. "You scared to come in? Well, that shows you're a good dog."
He handed him a piece of the cheese. I heard it rattle in his throat as he gulped it down. Grandpa came back and set little Ann up on the counter. He chuckled as he broke the cheese up in small pieces and fed her.
"Yes, sir," he said. "I think we have the best darn coon hounds in these Ozark Mountains. And just as sure as shooting, we're going to win that gold cup."
Grandpa didn't have to say that. The way I was feeling, I already had the cup. All I had to do was go and get it. Finished with his feeding of little Ann, Grandpa said,
"Now, let's see. The hunt starts on the 23rd. That's about, let's see. This is the 17th.
Counting on his fingers, he finally figured it out.
"That's 6 days from now," he said in a jubilant voice.
I nodded my head.
"We can leave here early in the morning on the 22nd, he said, "and barring accidents, we should make the campground in plenty of time for the grand opening."
I asked how we were going.
"We'll go in my buggy," he said. "I'll load the tent and everything the night before."
I asked him what he wanted me to bring.
"Nothing," he said, "but these 2 little hounds. And you be here early, and I believe I'd let these dogs rest, 'cause we want them in tip-top shape when we get there."
I saw the thinking wrinkles bunch up on Grandpa's forehead.
"You reckon your daddy would like to go?" he asked. "As late in the fall as it is, I don't think he's too busy, is he?"
"No, our crops are all gathered," I said. "We've been clearing some of the bottom land, but that's almost done now."
"Well, ask him," he said. "Tell him I'd like to have him go."
"I'll ask him," I said, "but you know how Papa is. The farm comes first with him."
"I know," Grandpa said, "but you ask him anyway and tell him what I said. Now, it's getting late and you had better be heading for home."
I was almost to the door when Grandpa said,
"Wait a minute."
He walked over behind the candy counter and shook out one of the quarter sacks. He filled it up to the brim, bounced it on the counter a few times, and dropped in a few more gumdrops. With a twinkle in his eye and a smile on his face, he handed it to me, saying,
"I saved some for your sisters."
I was so choked up I couldn't say anything. I took it and flew out the door, calling to my dogs. On my way home, I didn't walk on the ground. I was way up in the clouds, just skipping along. With a song, I told the sycamore trees and the pop-eyed gray squirrels how happy I was. Little Ann sensed my happiness. She pranced along on the trail with a doggish grin on her face. She begged for a piece of candy, which I so gladly gave.
Even old Dan felt the pleasant atmosphere. His long red tail fanned the air. Once he raised his head and bawled. I stood still and listened to the droning tones of his deep voice. The sound seemed to be trapped for an instant in the thick timber. It rolled around under the tall white sycamores, beat its way through the wild cane, and found freedom out over the clear blue waters of the river. The sound following the river's course rolled like the beat of a jungle drum. As the echo died away in the distance, silence settled over the bottoms. The gray squirrels stopped their chattering. The wild birds quit their singing. I stood still. No sound could be heard. It seemed that all the creatures of the wild were holding their breath. I gazed up to the towering heights of the tall trees. No leaf was stirring. The silence seemed strained and expectant, like a young boy waiting for a firecracker to explode. I looked at old Dan. He was standing perfectly still, with his right front foot raised and his long ears fanned open. He seemed to be listening and challenging any living creature to make a noise. The silence was broken by the whee of a red-tailed hawk. This seemed to be a signal. All around me, the happy atmosphere resumed its natural state. I heard the bam-bam-bam of a woodpecker high up in the top of a box elder snag. The cry of a kingfisher and the scream of a blue jay blended perfectly with a drum-like beat. A barking red squirrel glued to the side of a hackberry tree kept time to the music with the beat of his tail. Each noise I heard and each sight I saw was very familiar to me, but I never grew tired of listening and watching. They were a God-sent gift, and I enjoyed them all. As I skipped along, it was hard for me to realize all the wonderful things that had happened to me in such a few short years. I had two of the finest little hounds that ever bawled on the trail of a ringtail coon. I had a wonderful mother and father and three little sisters. I had the best grandpa a boy ever had, and to top it all, I was going on a championship coon hunt. It was no wonder that my heart was bursting with happiness. Wasn't I the luckiest boy in the world? Everyone was just sitting down to supper when I got home. My sisters quit the table for the candy. I told them to divide it equally. The oldest one asked if I wanted any of it. No, I said, I brought it all for you. Of course, I didn't tell them about the four pieces I had in my pocket. They thanked me with their clear blue eyes. I guess it's pretty hard for a young boy to fool his mama. She took one look at me and called me over. She ruffled up my hair, kissed me, and said, "If my little boy's eyes get any bigger, they're going to pop right out of his head. Now tell me, what are you so happy about?" Before I could say anything, Papa chuckled and asked, "What's going on between you and your grandpa? What are you and that old man cooking up now?" As fast as I could talk, I started telling about the big coon hunt. I told how hard Grandpa had been working to have my dogs entered, and how he had already paid my entry fee. Catching my breath and looking at Papa, I said, "We're going in his buggy, and he wants you to go." I waited in silence for his reply. Papa sat there, staring off into space, sipping his coffee and saying nothing. I knew he was thinking. In the silence, I was sure I could hear my heart thumping. I said, "Papa, please go. We'll have a lot of fun, and besides, the winner receives a big golden cup." He scratched his head and said, "Billy, I'd sure like to go, but I don't see how I can with all this work around here." I was beginning to think that Papa wasn't going to go. Then Mama started talking. "Work," she said. "Why, all the work is practically done. I don't know of one thing you couldn't put off for a few days. Why don't you go? You haven't been anywhere since I don't know when."
"Well, it's not only the work I'm thinking of," Papa said. "It's you and the girls."
"Why, don't worry about the girls and me," Mama said. "We'll be all right. Besides, it'll be several months yet before I need any help." When Mama said this, it dawned on me. I had been so busy with my coon hunting, I hadn't noticed anything unusual. Mama's tummy was all swelled up. She was going to have a baby. I felt guilty for not having noticed. I went over and put my arms around her and kissed her. Papa spoke up.
"It's sure going to be a big hunt," he said. "I heard something about it up at the store one day."
"Grandpa said there'll be hunters there from everywhere," I said, "and some of the best coon hounds in the country."
"Do you think you have a chance to win the cup?" Papa asked.
I started to answer him when the little one piped up.
"They can't beat old Dan and little Ann," she said. "I just bet they can't."
Everyone laughed at her serious remark. I would have kissed her, but she had candy, cornbread, and molasses all over her face. I told Papa I didn't know how good those dogs were, but there was one thing I did know. If they beat mine, they would have to hunt harder than they ever had before. After I had had my say about the dogs, a silence settled over the dining room. Everyone was looking at Papa and waiting for his answer. I saw a pleased smile spread over his face. He stood up.
"All right, I'll go," he said, "and by golly, we'll bring that gold cup back, too."
My sisters started clapping their hands and squealing with delight. A satisfied smile spread over my mother's face. At that moment, I'm sure no boy in the world could have been happier than I. Tears of happiness rolled down my cheeks. Mama wiped them away with her apron. In the midst of all the excitement, my little sister, saying not a word, climbed down from her chair. No one said anything. We just watched her. Still clutching a spoon in her small hand, she came around the table and walked up to me. Looking down at the floor in a bashful voice, she asked,
"Can I have the gold cup?"
Putting my finger under her sticky little chin, I tilted her head up. I smiled as I looked into her clear blue eyes. I said,
"Honey, if I win it, I'll give it to no one but you."
I had to cross my heart and hope to die several times before she was satisfied. Back in her chair, she gloated over the others.
"You just wait and see," she said. "It'll be all mine, nobody's but mine, and I'll put my banty eggs in it." "Silly, you don't put banty eggs in a gold cup," the oldest one said. "They're just made to look at."
That night I dreamed about gold cups, little red hounds, and coons as big as rain barrels. Once I woke myself up whooping to my dogs. The next few days were busy ones for me. Knowing that Papa and I would be gone for several days, I did everything I could to make things convenient for Mama. I chopped a large pile of wood and stacked it close to the kitchen door. To make it easy for her to feed our stock, I cut some poles from the hillside and boxed up one of the stalls in the barn. I filled it full of hay so she wouldn't have to climb the ladder to the loft. Papa laid down the law to my sisters about being good and helping Mama while we were gone. The day before we were to leave, I was as nervous as a June bug in a hen house. The day seemed endless. A few of the miserable hours were spent talking to my dogs. I told them all about the big hunt and how important it was. "Now, if you don't win the golden cup," I said, "I won't be mad, because I know you will do your best." Old Dan wouldn't even look at me and paid no attention to what I said. He was sulking because I hadn't been taking him hunting. When I talked to little Ann, it was different. She listened and seemed to understand everything I said. I dreaded to go to bed that night. I thought sleep would be impossible. I must have been more tired than I thought I was. I fell asleep almost immediately. Old Red, our rooster, woke me at daybreak, crowing his fool head off. It was a beautiful morning, clear and frosty. After a good breakfast, we kissed Mama goodbye and started for the store. I'm sure there were a lot of coon hunters in the Ozarks, but on that morning, none could have felt as big and important as I. Walking along by the side of my father, I threw out my chest and tried hard to keep pace with his long strides. He noticed and laughed. "You'll have to grow a little bit," he said, "before you can take steps that long." I didn't say anything, I just smiled.